It's time for TWiT This Week in Tech. Brian X. Chen from the New York Times is here. Ed Bott from ZDNet. And Gadget's Devendra Hardawar. Great panel. We'll talk about the HomePod. Good, bad, indifferent, progressive web apps, the big Falcon Heavy launch, Elon's amazing marketing, and a whole lot more. It's coming up next on TWiT.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT.
Bandwidth for This Week in Tech is provided by CacheFly at CacheFly.com. This is TWiT, This Week in Tech, episode 653, recorded February 11th, 2018. X stands for nothing. This Week in Tech is brought to you by Texture. Access the world's most popular magazines anytime, anywhere, using your smartphone or tablet. Go to texture.com/twit to start your free trial today. And by the Ring Video Doorbell. Stop crime before it happens and help make your neighborhood safer with Ring. Go to ring.com/twit and get up to $150 off a Ring of Security kit. And by FreshBooks, the easy-to-use cloud accounting software for small business owners. Make this year your most productive year yet. Try it free for 30 days at freshbooks.com/twit. And by Quip. Make a fresh start this year with a Quip electric toothbrush. It cleans like a premium electric toothbrush at a fraction of the cost. Visit getquip.com/twit to get your first refill pack free when you purchase any Quip electric toothbrush. It's time for TWiT This Week in Tech, the show where we talk about the week's tech news with some of the smartest people in tech. All the way on my left, Devendra Hardawar. He's the senior editor at Engadget. Great to have you, Devendra.
Hey, thanks for having me back.
From Brooklyn, New York.
Yes.
Welcome. From Santa Fe, New Mexico, Ed Bott from the Ed Bott Report on ZDNet. Always a pleasure. I've known Ed longer than any of you guys, for at least, we've been 20 years, 30 years almost.
It's decades.
You started doing the Dvorak radio show with us.
Yeah, Saturday mornings at...
a lot of fun.
Geez, some big AM station.
Yeah, some big AM station. That's it. It's good to have you, Ed. Also here, I think the first time in studio, though. I'm thrilled to have you, Brian X. Chen.
Nice to be in Petaluma. Thanks for having me again.
You came all the way to Petaluma.
Had a nice excuse to drive across the bridge.
You're in charge of consumer technology at the New York Times. Why am I telling you? You probably already knew that.
I'm the only person who writes about consumer technology at the time, so it's a flattering way to
really?
Say in
Are
charge.
You're the only one?
Only person on staff who has it as a beat, yeah. We have some freelancers, but
we quote you all the time, your byline all the time on the show.
For better or worse?
No, always, always. You're authoritative.
Oh,
and
thanks.
Actually, I thought it'd be kind of fun to there's so much to talk about. And we'll get to SpaceX in a second, because that's the happy news of the week. But the HomePod came out on Friday, and I'm sure you've been reviewing it. Devendra, you said something I thought fairly controversial.
Oh, no.
Which was that the iPhone X was Apple's last great product. Does that...
Yeah.
Since the only other product since then...
It wasn't that long ago. It was
is the HomePod. I'm thinking, is that a backdoor diss for the HomePod?
I mean, the HomePod was delayed, and even now it's like not fully ready. Brian's review is really good.
Don't rush to buy it, says Brian.
Yeah. Well, yeah, it's a half-baked product right now.
I don't know. I kind of feel like I was a little bit harder on it than other people. Do you guys feel that way?
You weren't as hard on it as I was.
Really? Okay. Because like I felt like it just feels like it's unfinished, right?
Because
Siri does a lot more on the iPhone than it does on the HomePod. And so it's been training us to use Siri in a certain way. And yet, you know, things like the calendar, which I use a lot with Siri, doesn't work on the HomePod. Things like hailing a car doesn't work on Siri on the HomePod, but it works on the iPhone and other things like that. You know, so it just feels like I don't know why they released it when it's not really done. I mean, indisputably, it's not done because that multi-room speaker feature is not out yet. So what I don't really get is if they're already late, why even come out when it's unfinished? It kind of makes it hard for me to write about, because I'm like, well, the music part sounds great, but all this other stuff doesn't work, and that's awkward.
Devendra, you agree?
I mean, I've only listened to it a bit. Chris Velasco at Engadget is going to be reviewing that for us. It sounds really good because it's a $350 super high-tech speaker. But yeah, I agree. The Siri stuff is, it feels really unfinished, really weak in comparison to what we're getting from Alexa speakers. I also tested out the Harman Kardon Invoke, which is the Cortana speaker. And even that felt more fully featured than the HomePod. And that thing's just $200.
So did either of you get invited to the briefings that Apple had in Cupertino?
Yeah. I went to the HomePod briefing about 2 weeks ago. We went to the Audio Lab tour where they showed us how they tested.
This was supposed to, you know, you're not getting the Kool-Aid soaked in. So let me channel Tim Cook here and say, but what you guys don't understand, it's not a Siri device. It's a speaker. It's all about the sound. We're reinventing how stereos, how speakers work. The Siri capability is merely to play music. You're thinking it's an Echo. It's not an Echo. It's a new kind of music listening device.
But yeah, so it was Phil Schiller who said that. And
No worries. Channeled the wrong guy.
Basically, he was saying he was giving us the history of how the HomePod was made, right? So it's been in development for 6 years on and off. Like, they tabled it for a little bit in between. And so they started it before Apple Music even launched, before they even bought Beats even, and before HomeKit came out, right? So the HomePod comes out after this. I mean, it's in development before that, but all this stuff comes out in the middle. And then suddenly they had to get this HomePod to work with these new services that Apple has, you know? So that's you can kind of get the sense of why it was so chaotic to develop this thing. But then when you try it, you're going to realize, like, this thing doesn't really seem like it's that polished. It doesn't really seem like it's done. So, I mean, how much can you justify it being that dumb? You know, it sounds amazing. It sounds great. But if you're competing...
this is where I would disagree.
Okay.
And I don't think it sounds that amazing.
Okay.
I think Apple fails on all fronts. Now, it sounds good. It sounds fine.
It's good.
That's the first I've heard. Okay.
Yeah. Because, look, I'll read some of the headlines. Apple HomePod review. This is Joanna Stern. Super sound, but not super smart. They agreed with you. The iMore folks. Retina for your ears.
I don't know about that.
Nilay Patel in The Verge said, I am a speaker fanatic. And he showed off his analog stereo. And I think this sounds amazing. But there's a problem. There's something called physics. And I know that... the Australian Prime Minister thinks that physics is not an immutable law, but I think physics is an immutable law. And this, which is not a HomePod, it's just an amazing simulation. This is too small to really be a great speaker. So I think if you're going to say it sounds good, you really should add the clause, it sounds good for its size.
Sure. That's a good point. And it definitely does fill up the whole room.
That's one thing that's interesting because it has
really
tweeters all around it. So it doesn't need... You don't need to sit in front of it. Everywhere is equal.
Yeah, and that's it. I'm not an audiophile, so I'm not going to pretend that I know great details about these seven tweeters and all that stuff and have a great attention to detail when it comes to sound. But, you know, it sounds really good to me compared to a lot of speakers I've tried. But I don't think that really justifies the fact that Siri is quite inadequate compared to how it even is on the iPhone or how it's compared to Alexa even. Here's a thought experiment, guys. So imagine if Apple had waited another year and made all those features work that are missing on Siri and released it as it is with nice music, nice sound, and all those nice features working as a virtual assistant.
Well, there's another problem. It only works with Apple Music. Here's my opinion. This is designed for somebody who is bathing in the warm glow of the Apple bath.
Right.
This is for somebody, because you can't even set it up if you don't have an iPhone or an iPad.
Not even a Mac. Can't use a Mac,
You cannot use it without an iPhone or an iPad.
Wow. So, okay.
That's insane. So this is a product designed for somebody who's absolutely in the, I'm not going to say Apple sheep, but somebody who's really in the Apple ecosystem and wants something that is already a subscriber to Apple Music, wants something that works with Apple Music. It sounds fine for its size. My issue is, we did a comparison yesterday on the new screensavers. We compared the Invoke, the Harman Kardon, which did not sound as good. The Sonos One, which is Sonos's small Play One speaker with Amazon Echo built in. Which actually wasn't as good, but was close. And it's half the price. You could buy two and get a stereo pair. That might be fairly competitive. We compared it.
Or get a Play 3 and an Echo Dot, right? There are other ways to do
that. Compared to a Play 3 or a Play 5, I don't think the Apple's HomePod is as good. And I guess the point I would really make is if you want a good speaker, if you want good sound, this is how I think of it. You know, I brought this up. Keith Richards, the guitarist for the Rolling Stone, wrote most of their songs with Mick Jagger. He got his musical education listening to a tinny transistor radio in bed, listening to a pirate radio station out in the ocean. It sounded crappy, but that's how he heard Howlin' Wolf and Muddy Waters and became, you know, a music fanatic. Paul McCartney, same thing. I mean, you can, you're still getting some music, but there's all the music that you would hear in a live performance. And then with each smaller device, each less capable device, you get less and less of the music. If you're really into music, you should freaking get a stereo. Spend a little bit more money and get a stereo. Get two speakers and sit at the apex of the triangle and listen. And if I put the, and I did this, put the HomePod in the middle and listen to my stereo, it's not, it's like a different song. It's like different music. It's completely a different experience. You're getting a half, a quarter of the full experience when you listen to the HomePod. So for Apple to say, well, no, no, it's not a Siri device, it's a new way of thinking about music, is wrong.
And you know, the deal breaker for me, too, that I wrote about in the review is it was picking the wrong music for me. You know, despite all the shortcomings of Siri, or in addition to all the shortcomings, I was trying to go along with like, oh, this should be primarily about music. This should be great at playing music. And, you know, in the Apple Music app, I selected all my favorite artists. They were like, you know, Smiths, Radiohead, Talking Heads, blah, blah, blah. And instead of picking artists similar to mine, I would ask Siri to play some music, and it would play Dashboard Confessional, which, I'm sorry, I hate that band so much.
I can beat that.
I
can
hate it so much.
I said, listen to classical music.
Right.
It played old school hip hop.
Okay.
Classical for some, but not what I was going for.
Sure.
I mean, you know, I like NWA as much as the next guy, but I was thinking something a little bit more mellow. I don't know. Baroque or something. And part of that is because Apple Music's problem, not the HomePod's problem, right?
I thought Apple Music was supposed to be better. So I'm not personally an Apple Music user. I use Spotify, but, you know, I had tested it before, and these For You playlists more or less had some pretty pretty spot on playlists generated for me back in the day.
Spotify's
when I was testing
good,
this.
I think.
Spotify's really good too. So when I first turned on the HomePod, I said play some music. I expected it to look at my history of what I listened to on Apple Music and also the artists that I picked, which is pretty obvious. And it was playing all this random stuff. Yeah. Dashboard Confessional being one. Lee Ray Francis, I've never listened to. Selena Gomez, I don't even know who these people are, really.
Selena Gomez.
Yeah, you know, like, it thinks I'm a 17-year-old or something.
I think in general, that is Apple Music. It's aimed at a generation, you know, that is a little, even you, who are a lot younger
than me. Supposed to be listening to what I like. That's the whole point of it. So that was really the deal breaker
for me. Well, by the way, go look in Apple Music for classical music. Good luck finding it. Seriously, it's not.
Here's the thing. Here's the thing, though. You make a good point about is this if you really want the audio experience, then get a stereo. But the point of all these devices, the Sonos, the Echo, the Invoke, which I have one of here, and this HomePod, the whole point of it is that you shouldn't have to whip out a phone or an iPad. You should be able to just drive the thing by talking.
Right.
Right.
And so even if it isn't as intelligent as the others, even if it doesn't have the full Siri experience, you should at least be able to go through the basics and say, play this, play that, play the other thing, get my entire music collection from the cloud, play this album or that album. And from what I understand, it doesn't do that. And if it doesn't do that, I think Brian's absolutely right. Why did they ship this thing? There's a case to be made sometimes for shipping things early when they have to be out in the world and people have to be interacting with them so that the engineers can get feedback and they can fine tune the thing quickly. But that's not the case here. They just shipped this thing before it was ready. And given the amount of money that Apple has in the bank, I just don't understand why.
Yeah, it almost feels like they have competitive pressure because Amazon made a killing during the holidays. They slashed the price of the Echo to $85 from $99. I think those are the numbers. So, you know, they have more pressure than ever to put this thing out. But at the same time, Apple has been saying for years, like, we don't rush to be first, right? We're fine with being later and doing a better job than everybody else. And in this case, I mean, I think they could only say that, you know, maybe Leo disagrees, but they did better with audio quality, but they really just dropped the ball on everything else.
It's decent for what it is. You know, there are times when you would want a HomePod. For instance, in the kitchen, it's great because you don't stand. I mean, if you're listening to music, you don't always get to sit in the, you know, sweet spot with two speakers left and right.
Yeah.
You're in the kitchen. You're cooking. You're moving around. And it's great for that because of the tweeters all the way around. And it sounds good no matter where you are. So I think it's – but it's a single – it's a mono speaker. They don't have any stereo option.
Well, you can add a second speaker that plays at the same time, like next to it. You can in a future software update.
In a future update.
And that's my point, right? It's not done. Yeah. So why didn't they wait like 6 months or something to ship a perfectly polished product that would have been really nice?
I think I blame Apple a little bit because I think the white earbuds that they shipped with the iPhone and the iPod before it degraded the musical tastes of a whole generation. That people who grew up with crappily compressed music on crappy earbuds.
You mean the AirPods or the
No, 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 oh, just ones. For years.
The original.
Yeah.
The original.
Music
classic.
For a whole generation meant an iPod with white earbuds in, and that is not, frankly, very good quality.
Right.
And I don't want Apple to start saying how great this sounds because I think it's doing a disservice to people who could hear a lot more of the music. You can't get a speaker that size for $350 that's going to be a great speaker. You can't. It's great for its size. And I think there are even better speakers for that price, frankly.
Yeah. So the Sonos Play 3 is, what, $300?
Yeah,
I think, and that thing sounds a lot better.
I think so. Just as it has more bass, for one thing.
It has more bass. But, you know, to Apple's credit, I think what they did really well with the HomePod is that you can push that thing to max volume, and it won't distort.
Like, it does handle high
Nothing
volume.
Distorts. I think partially because it doesn't really go as max as some other things, right? We were comparing it to the Google Max, and that thing goes much louder, and then you start to hear like the bass starts to distort and you know, some of the high notes. So you could see that Apple's trying to balance something here, but I think you're onto something, Leo. Like, everybody who grew up with iPods or just in general, we got used to okay sounding music, and most people just don't have speakers in their homes. I think that's a
even with
thing
surround,
too.
Even like with surround, maybe because people my age
that's
might
a cinephile
surround.
Thing.
Yeah, because you're watching movies on your big screen.
Like
TV.
I have all that stuff, but I know I'm way in like the minority here. But
I think
in
more
general,
people
like,
than you think have have home theater systems, right? Maybe not. I don't know.
It's a good portion of people, but it's not. I'm talking like mainstream consumers. So like just listening to music, you know, in your home with speakers,
and this
is something that kind of died off.
I
and
know.
This
people
is good
bought,
for that.
People in my generation bought the stupid Bose sound acoustic wave.
Oh God,
radio,
and those were
right?
terrible.
The Paul
those
Harvey
never sounded
was,
good.
Yeah, I mean, there's so I don't know. And by the way,
my big.
My ears are shot from years of wearing headphones and listening to rock and roll way too loud. But I can tell the difference. Yeah. And so I figured that somebody younger with better ears owes themselves something a little bit better. The Sonos Play 3 is $250. It's $100 less.
Oh, wow.
So for $50 more, you can get a Play 5, which really sounds good. And even then, though, I wish you would spend a little more and get a stereo.
You know, well, that's like the ultimate dream. I would wish more consumers would do that. But what I love about these devices is that Sonos and everything, like it made it easy for everybody to bring music out loud back into their homes. The big downside with HomePod for me is that it's so limited, right? It's limited to Apple Music, but so many people are using Spotify now, or you have your library of music on other devices. You know, there's no aux jack, of course. There's none of the things you see even in simple Bluetooth speakers these days. I really like what Logitech's been doing, honestly. Like, they just released their new lineup, which has Alexa built in, and they're also, like, Bluetooth portable speakers that you can take around everywhere. You could put them in the shower, or you could take them to the beach. Like, there's so much innovation happening here. Like, what HomePod offers just doesn't feel like it's enough today.
Well, okay. I mean, I think we're beating a dead horse. But it makes me feel bad. I think, Ed, you're right. I mean, I think the future, and by the way, this device, the HomePod, is great for podcasting, as is the Amazon Echo and even the Invoke, because you can, by voice in your house, say, "Let's, you know, let me listen to Twit or let me listen to your podcast," and you know, slash film, and that's great for podcasting. It puts podcasting in a way ahead of radio, in a way that I think is going to be very good for us. So, I'm not knocking these devices, and I agree with you, Ed, that that's but Apple's not selling that. Apple's selling it as a great speaker, and I think that's doing us a disservice. If you just said, "Here's a pretty good speaker that you can listen to music on in your kitchen. That's what it is. Sure. Mm-hmm. I'll give you that. And Ed, you're right. I mean, the Siri at least does that much. It plays music. Apple Music. The fact it doesn't do Spotify is that's going to come too, right?
I feel like the HomePod is going to be one of those products I might review again a year later. Because it feels like, oh, by then they'll probably open it to Spotify, yada, yada, and all those features that I mentioned are probably going to work by then. And it'll probably be a great product by then.
It reminds me of the Apple Watch, which in the first couple of generations was not compelling.
Yeah, but they really nailed it on version 3. Yeah,
yeah. I think I'm actually wearing this now every day.
Well, this was actually the original problem with the original iPhone as well. You know, most people forget that the original iPhone, it didn't support apps. It didn't have an app store. It didn't support Exchange Mail. It had a whole bunch of things that were wrong with it, and they fixed that over the first year. But that was also one of the things that had to go out into the world and be used by people to improve in that fashion. And
it still blew other smartphones away at the time, didn't it? Like the keyboard is awesome and Safari browser was amazing compared to the really pared down browsers on old cell phones. So even though there were all these things missing, it's hard to compare with the HomePod, I think, where like the iPhone at least was a working functional product.
That's a good point. The HomePod's late to a market with a lot of competition.
I mean, the iPhone was late to the smartphone market as well, but it just did a better job at a lot of things.
And you look back at the iPod, like that was super limited too, right? Didn't that only work with Macs for a long time, ignoring the biggest PC market?
Maybe a year or two, I don't remember. But they put it out on Windows, and that's when it became really big, the iPod.
So. For sure.
You know what's funny is we come almost full circle now because Microsoft's been pushing this. They're probably at the Build conference. They're going to talk a lot about progressive web apps, which... are
exactly.
Different. They're different, but in a way, they're the same as the web apps for the original iPhone. The idea that you would go to a website and you'd save it on your home screen, and now that's an app on your iPhone. That's what I'm excited about. Progressive web apps, though, Ed. I feel like I wish Apple would get behind that. They're being a little slow to the party.
I think so too. But in both of these cases, in the case of progressive web apps and in the whole competition with Spotify thing, what you're really seeing here is Apple protecting its sort of core services. And in a way, that's very, very Microsoft-like.
Yep.
They're refusing to disrupt themselves. And in fact, there was some, forget who wrote this last week, but somebody did a study showing that Apple Music subscriptions are rising faster than Spotify subscriptions, and Apple Music will probably catch up with Spotify by the end of this year in terms of the install base. And so, you know, a cynic could look at this and say, well, one reason that Apple's not putting Spotify on this and they're making it difficult for Spotify to succeed in the Apple hardware ecosystem is specifically so that Apple Music can surpass Spotify in terms of market share. Mm-hmm. A lot of money there.
The proof of that is there's no Bluetooth in the HomePod.
Yeah.
Something that would allow you to open it up to an Android device, for instance.
You could still AirPlay, right? So you can still AirPlay from your iPhone or iPad with Spotify or
Apple
whatever.
Technology.
Yeah. It's proprietary, but you could still use that for Spotify. So something.
Well, I mean, let's look at the Apple Watch for comparison, right? So the Apple Watch, you have to have an iPhone to set it up, right? And it's still that way, even though it's more independent than it was before. But the Apple Watch so far seems pretty successful. So, and you know, this is some inside information, but I've heard that they have considered sharing the Apple Watch with Android phones. But what's stopping them is that so many Android people are switching to the iPhone. So why would they give people incentive to, you know, stay with Android if so many people are switching to the iPhone? You know, so that's how these decisions are made. But my point being that, you know, counter argument, the Apple Watch only works with the iPhone, and yet people seem to love it, and it's still pretty successful.
If you're in the, you know what, I bet Ed would agree with this. The advantage of an ecosystem play like that and siloing it like that is you can make it a seamless, great experience. And Apple has done that. So if you live in the Apple world, you've got continuity, you know, you've got handoff, you've got all this great stuff. then your life is easy and smooth, and it's better not to have to think about these other guys and what speaker's better. You just buy the Apple speaker because it's an Apple speaker. That's
and
the
that advantage. Sounds like that sounds like laziness, right? Like what Ed was saying, that
but
is totally a Microsoft move. People are happy. Like, yeah, they'll drink whatever you give them, but this doesn't feel like the same Apple
You can't deny it's profitable.
Yeah, it certainly is. But right, Apple killed the iPod market with the iPhone, right? The iPhone had to kill the iPod.
Right.
Like think of like how impactful.
And Apple's willing
to
do that. Apple's always been willing to do that, which is
are they anymore?
Oh, you think they're not anymore?
We're talking about how safe the HomePod is, and I think that's exactly
good
it.
Point.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, when 70% of your revenue as it comes from the iPhone, as does Apple's,
right,
it's pretty hard to imagine killing the iPhone.
Not the iPhone, but something like killing its own services, right? Like Apple Music, okay, it hasn't been super successful initially, but as I was pointing out, it's growing.
Are bigger for Apple, a bigger portion of their revenue than either the Mac or the iPad.
Yep.
Services are $10 billion a quarter for Apple. So you don't want to kill those either.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, you saw the Wall Street Journal said at the growth rate Apple Music's going through, 5% a month, it's going to eclipse Spotify soon.
I wonder who leaked that statistic.
Yeah, Journal's really good at repeating those.
Convenient timing.
Yeah. With Spotify's about 2%. They don't include, of course, the free tier, which Apple doesn't have, and Spotify has hundreds of 140. Mm-hmm.
They have a 3-month trial or something, or is it 1 month? I forgot.
3 months, yeah. Mm-hmm.
They don't count the family subscriptions either. But
right. So, Ed, do you think admitting that an ecosystem play is strong for Apple, you think in the long run, though, it's going to hurt them as it did Microsoft?
Well, it has to because, look, I think that it's a justification to say, the seamless experience is the goal here. That's a great rationalization. But the reality is there's just so much money coming into Apple's coffers. And when you sit down in a product meeting and somebody says, okay, I've got this great idea, but it's going to hurt this business that's bringing us $10 billion a quarter, there's somebody there who's going to say, nope, we don't do that. We're not going to do that. And that ultimately, once the numbers get that big, once the fiefdoms, the individual fiefdoms within, the giant spaceship there become powerful enough, then they start to block innovation and they start to build moats around each of their businesses. And I've seen that play happen before. It's what happened to Microsoft in, it led to Windows Vista.
And I have on my wall, and I'm very happy to have it, a signed copy of this fabulous cartoon from Bonkers World of the various org charts. And of course, Microsoft's was all the fiefdoms shooting at all the other fiefdoms. And it really hurt Microsoft badly. And actually, to Satya Nadella's credit, I think he's changed Microsoft, and the attitude is very different now. It's
dramatically,
and it's made a difference in their operations significantly.
For sure. Yeah. I feel like I bring this up every time I come on, but it does feel like Microsoft is doing a lot of the Apple-y stuff, right? Like the Surface, the innovation behind the Surface laptops, the Surface Book, the Surface Studio that you're using right now, Leo, like these cool new devices that we're sitting here and watching Apple take away the ports people actually use on their MacBook Pros and give us keyboards that everybody hates that keyboard. And like, I don't see we're seeing any indication that that's going to be fixed eventually. Like Apple's just going with the super flat design. A lot of things that we expect Apple to fix, we're just not seeing anymore. And that's worrying me, honestly. Like, I think to me, like Tim Cook is feeling more and more like Steve Ballmer. Like he's doing a good job of really, pushing every product line and ramping everything up. But I don't know if we're going to see the innovation that we're kind of used to expecting from Apple.
Yeah. Let's take a little bit of a break. When we come back, we're going to talk about the feel-good story of the week. We watched it live on Tuesday. We interrupted Mac Break Weekly to watch the Falcon Heavy launch. And I really loved Elon Musk's marketing. He went on one of the early morning shows that day and said, well, the engineers tell me there's about a 1 chance in 3 it's going to blow up. I think it's about 1 chance in 2. Why would how would you not watch this launch? if there's a chance, that that's going to be the biggest explosion in the history of mankind. You'd have to watch, right? It turned out, of course, to be flawless, and there were some really amazing moments. We'll talk about that. But first, I want to talk about our sponsor, Texture. Texture is single-handedly, I think, saving magazines. And I love magazines. Some of the best writing today comes from The New Yorker and The Atlantic and, yeah, even Rolling Stone. But the problem is if you were to subscribe to all these magazines, besides your coffee table buckling, your checkbook would buckle under the weight. You can't go in and buy individual magazines. So Texture is like the best solution. It's kind of, think of it as Netflix for magazines. One very low flat rate for over 200 of the nation's best magazines. And you get every page of the magazine that's on the newsstand, plus past issues, plus bonus features you can't get in magazines like video. National Geographic, Hollywood. I get stuff like Ad Age and Hollywood Reporter, which I would probably not subscribe to because they're so darn expensive. But I can read it. I can keep up on my industry. I can see the Billboard Hot 100. Yeah, occasionally I might want to look at People magazine. I certainly wouldn't want to subscribe to it. Vanity Fair. And what's really nice about the images, I love photography. Vanity Fair has its 24th annual Hollywood issue right now. Here it is on my iPad. And what's fun is, yeah, it's going to be just like the magazine, by the way, including the ads, but you can also zoom in. So if you want to see this famous third leg problem here, you can zoom in and say, oh, they fixed it. Oh, this is funny. Or did they? What's going on? You can zoom in on that. Actually, I think this is different than the cover. I think they fixed the third leg problem. Who is that? That's Reese Witherspoon. Oprah said, I think there's a Photoshop issue because her leg shouldn't be bending like that. I guess that's true. And they think that that was two pictures blended together. Well, you can really do some pixel peeping if you want. And you can read, of course, every article. And it's easy, too, because the table, this is one example, this is Vanity Fair, but the table of contents goes right to the article. So you say, oh, I want to read all about Steve. And you can see it. Great political writing, great news writing. Texture even has a curated section that I love that shows highlights. So, you know, you can see stories just for you, new and noteworthy stories, long reads for the week. Why is no profit Tesla so loved by Wall Street? That's a good one. Car and Driver, look at this. There's so many great magazines, and it's going to be a free trial for you. If you go to texture.com/twit, try it for free. If you decide to buy, $9.99 a month for unlimited access to more than 200 magazines. Texture.com/twit. They automatically download on my iPad, so when I'm traveling, I know I've got 20 magazines in my briefcase. I love it. Texture.com/twit. Try it free right now. Brian X. Chen is here from the New York Times. He's their one and only, it says, lead consumer technology writer.
Solo consumer technology
writer.
He's
in the front. He's in the back. He's everywhere. He's
kind of like the HomePod.
Nice that you came up. I appreciate it. Yeah, Apple's only speaker. They actually did a speaker, didn't they? The Hi-Fi, the iPod mm-hmm. Hi-Fi. That flopped pretty quickly.
Although, we're trying to track one down. Yeah,
I remember Steve Jobs at the event, because that was when I got to still go to events, saying, and Steve was an audiophile, famous, loved his music, had tube amps and all that stuff and big clip shorts. He said, he's such a good marketer, I'm throwing away all of my audio equipment. This iPod Hi-Fi is so good. I went, yeah, right, Steve.
Yeah.
Also, Devendra Hardawar from Engadget. Ed Bott is also here from ZDNet. Great to have you all. Okay. Did you watch the Falcon Heavy launch?
Of course.
Yeah. I haven't seen it.
What? Brian X. Chen. You're kidding me. You haven't seen
it's
it?
Too busy writing about the HomePod.
Okay, what?
Live view of the Falcon
Sorry.
Heavy.
Let me turn down the sound a little bit. And we'll you can actually go watch this on YouTube at the SpaceX channel. This is, now, John is our space expert. John, I think I've been saying this wrong. This is the largest rocket ever operational. So the Saturn V, which took man to the moon, was bigger. But this is big because in order to get a manned flight to Mars, you need to get enough velocity to get there, right? Not just to break out of Earth orbit. So should we watch just a little bit of the countdown?
STS is ready for launch.
This was so exciting. I've watched every space launch. I'm sure you did too, Edwin, as a kid.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
They did a good job of programming this whole thing, too. Like,
yeah, this is their feed.
It was really well done.
Yeah. And they had, you'll hear crowd noise mixed in. And now remember, no one knows if, you know, if 27 engines, if one's off by just a bit, it goes sideways. It could blow up. It really is just a giant bomb on a stick. Perfect. Perfect.
It looks like Elon Musk's middle finger to Earth. Just like, screw you guys. I'm out of here.
I'm going. I'm gone. Let's see, booster engine cutoff. Let me jump ahead. This is my favorite part, the booster landing.
Mm-hmm. Right. The landing, the twin landing was...
Oh, my God, was that amazing, right?
Yeah.
Let me see if I can find that. Because they, you know, this the Challenger, they're... Oh, look at... Oh, it's like... Oh, these rockets land themselves after they're done. Listen to the crowd. They really did mix that in, didn't they? Wait a minute, I got to see that again. That's just too good. So the boosters are bringing themselves in. The third engine, the main engine, did get lost at sea.
And the landing burn has started.
It's like a rock concert.
Boosters looking to be on track towards their respective landing zones.
Boosters landing burns have started.
This is brilliant production, right? Look at the legs come down. I think I just wet myself. That is so incredible.
And the Falcons have landed.
LZ1, LZ2.
See what you missed, Brian?
Oh.
And you're reviewing the HomePod? What are you, nuts?
Yeah, I'm a loser.
All right, one more thing, though, we got to talk about. Brilliant marketing. So as I didn't believe it when he said it, but Elon Musk said, we're going to put my Tesla, cherry red Tesla Roadster, my original Tesla, on the rocket as a test payload. We're going to have a dummy in there dressed as Starman, and there'll be a loop of David Bowie's Space Oddity playing. What I didn't know is that the fairings would come off the capsule, that there were cameras all around it, and that they would stream, thanks to NASA's high-altitude streaming system, they would stream pictures of the Starman with the Earth settling as he rotates around the Earth, sun rising and setting in the background. Just beautiful images. And by the way, you know, it doesn't say Tesla in the screen. It could have. It says don't panic. But we can't forget there's a little bit of a T there on the steering wheel. This is about the best ad for Tesla ever, right? I mean, this is great marketing. Look at that. I just love that. I want a screensaver of Starman just going around the Earth. So then they launched out of Earth orbit they stayed there for a while, right, John? A few hours?
Yeah.
And then they launched out of Earth orbit on its way to Mars. Is it going to slingshot around Mars and then come back?
Yeah, all the way to the asteroid belt.
Where it's going to end its trip and orbit the sun forever and ever, or until it's pulverized by atomic dust, whichever comes first.
So kind of like us.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes. Just an amazing, great marketing. You got to say that. But at the same time, it makes people feel good. Jeff Jarvis tweeted, this reminds him of the 60s. Chaos below and hope above. Okay. Nothing more to say. Brian, you just, just forget that HomePod.
And yet, they were having trouble making Tesla Model 3s.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, should we mention $675.3 million quarterly loss?
Slight problem, yeah.
Only $250,000 went into orbit with that Roadster, according to Cat Hall writing for the Register. I love the Register's headlines.
They pick such a great picture of Elon there also.
Yeah. Yeah, we wonder what's going through his mind. I should say, full disclaimer, I drive and purchased a Tesla because I wanted to support what he's up to. I think Tesla's pretty exciting. The Model 3 has been a troubling.
Mm-hmm.
500,000 people on the waiting list. I am one of them. I admit I put
$1,000
down.
Oh, you're going to get two Teslas.
Not yet. I'm 18 months out. Oh, I do. I have a little toy Tesla in the hallway, but I got that for free. I didn't pay for that. I got that because somebody bought a Tesla and used my name. Thank you, whoever you are.
I've seen people like posting their Twitter pics and Instagram pics of getting their Model 3. So it's happening, and that's something. It's just not as fast as
it should be. I haven't heard problems with the people who own them. Have you?
No, I haven't really heard any either.
Playing the wrong music.
It's playing the wrong music?
Dashboard confessional keeps coming.
Terrible. Oh, man. Actually, that is something surprising that Teslas do not support Android Auto or CarPlay, Apple's solution.
I think that's a good thing.
Do you?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, personally, so I have a pretty old Prius. I know that's lame, but I just stick in my iPhone and use Bluetooth to control Spotify and whatever I want. And I don't want any of this Apple CarPlay or Android. What's it called? Android Play? I don't know.
You already sound like an old man, Auto. Brian.
I know. When I rent cars, I rent cars every now and then when I travel, right? And I have to use these Apple CarPlay features because I have an iPhone. And it barely works, right? Like, it has like four apps or something, and it forces you to use Apple Maps. And why would you want to do that versus using Google Maps, you know? So, I don't know. I don't want any of this stuff.
Elon Musk.
I have a fairly new car that supports both.
What do you think? Do you use it?
Yes, I use it. I use it with both because with both Android Auto and CarPlay. And to Brian's point, I prefer Android Auto because the Google Maps experience is better. Is much better. But either one is better than the built-in navigation system. And the one I have, it's a Lincoln, and it's a very nice, it's their Sync 3.
You have fourth Sync in there, yeah. In fact,
which is a BlackBerry based thing, and it's very good software. But you know, the voice control is just, you have to be so precise with it, and if you say the wrong words in the wrong order, it won't do your navigation for you. Whereas both Android Auto and CarPlay just work when you press the little speech button and tell them where you want to go. It takes you there and puts the map up there. So I'm actually a big supporter of those things.
I mean, if you think about it, the time to update a car, design and build and update a car is years, but these phones are iterated every year. The software is iterated more often than that. You would probably prefer to have up-to-date Google Maps or Apple Maps in your car than whatever was put on that car when it was made.
True. I mean, do these cars update the software that often? Like with the
you
maps?
You can. It's not easy. Sometimes you have to bring it to the dealer. Sometimes you have to download something, put it on a USB key, carry it out to the auto, start up the auto, press some buttons. Maybe it'll update. And then
let the auto run for a half an hour.
Yeah.
Well, does the update.
Hope it doesn't. Hope you don't brick your car.
When I updated the Sync 3, there was one thing, and it said in the instructions, because I read the instructions first, and it said, now, when you get towards the end of this, it's going to tell you that it's done, but it's not really done.
Oh,
all
geez.
That means is that step is done, but it looks like the entire thing is done. So don't pull the USB stick out yet because it's not really done.
And these are the people we hope will design autonomous vehicles.
Oh, boy.
Their car companies are not great at software. Sync, I liked the base Sync, but then they did my Ford Touch. They screwed it up. Actually, it's interesting because Ford says now they're going to put Amazon's Echo in their cars. The next generation, I think, is going to have Amazon's voice services.
I mean, the car company just can't do it anymore on their own. So that's why we don't really trust. I don't know if we'll see their self-driving being the things that take off, right?
I like Elon Musk's response, by the way, in the quarterly call when he was unfortunately having to talk about the big loss and the trouble with the Model 3. He said, well, we can send a Roadster to the asteroid belt. I think we could figure out how to make the Model 3.
I don't know.
That's not a good answer.
Bad answer. Not related. If we could send a roadster to the ass, we've brought. All right.
Well, it is the funny thing, though, about it's both a software and a hardware problem. But the interesting thing is that they have the design of the car down very well. They have the components all built and everything. It's getting the manufacturing at scale and speed. That is the problem. And so that's one of those things where you have you know, it's a problem that goes back to Henry Ford, and you have to, you know, the assembly line has to be running at the exact same speed from start to finish. If there's any slowdown along the way, every other part of it backs up at the beginning. It doesn't have product at the end. So there's like probably maybe only half a dozen little problems affecting the Model 3 manufacturing line, and so, you know, one of these days they'll solve the last one of those. Click. And then all of a sudden they're, you know, maybe they really are manufacturing 5,000 or 10,000 cars a week like they say they can. We'll see.
That was always the knock on Tesla, is that when the big three, when the automakers who have a lot of experience bending metal come in, they're just going to take over, that Tesla can't possibly compete in mass production. I have to say I'm rooting for them. Do you think all these companies doing electric vehicles if it weren't for Tesla?
No, probably not.
Yeah. I think they help.
That's a sad thing. It's sad that we have to kind of rely on this crazy billionaire to kind of get out there and make all these things happen. But yeah.
Well, I think we've always relied on the crazy billionaires to get things done. I think that's true. That's a longstanding
trend. Like the old media barons, same deal.
Yeah, the railroad barons. It takes a certain amount of chutzpah, self-confidence, and a lot of capital to move things forwards. Otherwise, you just keep making iPhones. Speaking of which, Apple's the only company that has said how it's going to spend its repatriated cash. The new tax law pretty much, I think, forced companies to pay the 15% tax and get their overseas funds back. Apple has billions of dollars. In fact, the five largest U.S. technology companies have $500 billion in overseas cash. Microsoft, Alphabet, Amazon, all of them took hits from the new tax bill. Google actually had a loss in its quarter because of a $9.9 billion tax bill.
So did Microsoft.
Yeah. I mean, what was Microsoft's tax bill? It was huge, right?
It was like $9 billion, I think, or $15 billion or something. $15 billion and a $9 billion loss that translated to a $9 billion loss.
Microsoft has the second most overseas money after Apple, I think. I think it was one, two.
Yeah, and both of those companies have done, you know, they've played this interesting game with Irish subsidiaries.
It's the double Irish and the Dutch sandwich.
Yep.
Sounds kind of dirty.
It sounds delicious.
No, it sounds like something that you just don't want to Google.
It sounds like Urban Dictionary might have something to say about it.
Yeah.
But it is, in fact, the kind of, it's completely legal, but somewhat, I think, ethically challenged idea that you transfer, in Apple's case, they transferred intellectual property rights for a lot of their products to an Irish subsidiary and then started making payments to the Irish subsidiary for the right to make the iPhone. And the Irish subsidiary turned around and used, I think, the Canary Islands that's the Dutch sandwich, to further launder the money, paying zero or very low or zero corporate taxes on the money. Apple ended up paying, though, $38 billion in a one-time tax payment to repatriate its hundreds of billions of dollars. Apple said that they are going to use that money to create jobs. I think that this is just all aimed at President Trump. We're going to create jobs. We're going to build a beautiful new headquarters in Nevada for 30.
Bigly.
Yeah. You know, the complicated part of this is that they were already planning on spending X amount of money this year.
Right.
And they have a spending rate of, I forgot how many million dollars or billion dollars it was for each year. And they would have already reached that goal despite the repatriation. So, like, what I'm trying to say is they were going to spend that money anyway, and they're just timing it in accordance to, you know, what's going on in politics to make it sound like they're doing this for the sake of,
well, mm-hmm, we all have to be political,
jobs,
right?
You know?
Yeah.
But that
happened with a lot of like job, like hirings from other companies too, right? Yeah.
Microsoft's CFO might have been a little more forthcoming when she was on the call with the analyst. Amy Hood said, when we see an opportunity to invest, we haven't really waited for tax reform to do that. Microsoft, which has $132 billion that it will repatriate, says no change. Alphabet, which has $61 billion to repatriate, says no change. Amazon says, hey, we already spent a lot on our workforce. We're not. They have $61 billion. Facebook, 16. Oh, no, I'm sorry. Alphabet at $61 billion. Amazon only had $10 billion. So it's not going to change. In fact, according to the Wall Street Journal, Apple's the only company that had that said that they're going to take this money and do anything different with it.
Right, but they always had the option. And what they've done for years now is they just borrowed money. And right. especially since interest rates have been, you know, essentially close to zero, 0%.
Apple has $100 billion yeah. in borrowed money.
Yeah, and they were paying, you know, and they were paying. I don't know what their corporate. I mean, they're. I'm sure those are AAA rated bonds, so probably just a couple percent that they're paying there, which was way better than the difference between the you know, with the 25% or 30% or 35% tax right. rate that they were right. going to pay on it. You know, so it was, and you know, this is just. There's absolutely no difference in how any of these companies are responding to the markets. They all have so much money available to invest. If they want, they're all investing in cloud infrastructure. They're, you know, CapEx like crazy, building, you know, building manufacturing capacity for the, you know, for products. It just the idea that they're going to do anything different aside from pocket the money and buy back stock and maybe issue a dividend is just nuts.
Yeah. Speaking of Apple, which we have been quite a bit, I apologize. The source code for their boot code, iBoot, was posted publicly by a supposedly low-level employee, don't know how he or she got the code, on GitHub. Of course, taken down, Apple filed a copyright claim and forced the company to remove the code, but not quickly enough that people didn't download it. I'm sure there's copies all over the place. iBoot is the part of the iOS operating system that's responsible for ensuring a trusted boot of the operating system. So it's I would say for jailbreakers and others, this code is a huge deal. Jonathan Levin, who is a jailbreaker, has written a number of books on iOS and Mac internals, said this is the biggest leak in history. It's a huge deal. But that was right away. I don't know, maybe if he looked at the code. Apple said this is old code. In fact, you see copyright 2006, 2007 to 2014. So it is fairly old code. May not have anything to do with how current iPhones boot.
Yeah, I think we need like a security researcher to comment on this, right? Yeah. Like, is this really a right. big deal? If it's iOS, is it 8 or 9? We're on 11 now.
Except when you are dealing with code that's basically touching bare metal, at that point, those things don't get changed with each release. Those are, I mean, that's like the Linux kernel. Or you know, Microsoft's kernel or the mock kernel. The kernel is not something that changes with every version. It gets tweaked, it gets improved. There are security enhancements made to it, but by and large, that thing is, you know, that's the core. That's the core, and it doesn't over time. It doesn't change that much, and you know. Because it's just so basic, you don't dare change it. Every little tiny tweak that you make at that level has the potential to ripple up through everything else. And so, you know, those things don't change that often.
I feel like if there's a flaw in it, it will be exposed. And this might actually benefit Apple if somebody comes forward and tries to get a bug bounty. Actually, the bug bounties for iBoot are the largest bug bounties Apple offers, mm-hmm. hundreds of thousands of dollars. This might be not a bad thing for Apple.
It also benefit the FBI if they want to hack another
iPhone.
Yeah, right?
NSA's going, yeah, baby, yeah. Finally, we get
GitHub,
into that
sweet.
iPhone. I'm a T-Mobile customer. I think a lot of T-Mobile customers got a text message, scared the hell out of me, saying... quickly add a PIN to your account because there's an industry-wide phone hijacking scam. I got this. I don't know if you did. T-Mobile alert, we've identified an industry-wide phone number port out scam, which means somebody calls a representative and says, hey, I want to take my phone number to another phone. And of course, when they do that, that will break, you know, two-factor authentication using texts, which is one of the reasons that is not a good way to do two-factor. A lot, my bank still does. A lot of banks do. Motherboard says that a company representative said its entire postpaid customer base was messaged. So if you didn't get the alert, you probably will. I immediately called T-Mobile and put a pin on my account. But I'm wondering if this has all of a sudden been a big problem. I can't think of another time a company's done this, you know, said to everybody, turn on two-factor on your account.
I mean, this is a thing that, honestly, we should be doing anyway. So I don't, maybe when people create T-Mobile accounts, they should be like making this more mandatory or something. I think we've seen instances where somebody's, you know, information, a hacker is able to social engineer and get control of somebody's account. And usually it's because there's no PIN, there's no like extra authentication on their account.
Right. And, the weak spot is aptly named customer service personnel, customer service representatives. They get called and they're trying to serve the customer. The problem is it's not really the customer. It's somebody pretending to be the customer, and they try to be helpful and they end up not servicing the customer. So I called and I got one very quickly, just a public service message. On any mobile account that you can do that with, you should probably do that. SIM hijacking is very real.
I had an interesting experience in regards to that, Leo. I have an account with a company called Ting.
Oh, yeah. I have a Ting account. They're great. They used to be a sponsor.
They're really, really great. Yeah. Really, really great service. And I was porting a number into it, and something went wrong with it. And at any rate, long story short, in order for me to complete the port, I had to go through a process with their security people that basically involved, it's the same sort of challenges that you would get if you're applying for a mortgage and doing online stuff, where they said, you applied for an automobile loan in 2015. What company was that with? And it gives you four choices. Right. And a lot of times all of them are wrong. And I had to answer about 10 questions like that before they would even allow me access to my account. And that, so that was reassuring in a way.
Yes, a pain in the butt, but still.
Yeah, but I'd rather it's not nearly as much of a pain in the butt as having someone have access to essentially what is the universal 2FA device, and then whoops, they're into your bank accounts and they're into your credit cards and everything.
Another fix for this is to tell your bank and everybody else should stop using text messages. Use authenticator programs or some better solution than text messages.
We're just getting started, but
I feel it's so hard to get people to use two-factor in the first place, right? Yeah. So I think they just are holding people's hands and saying, start with the text messaging thing, because no one uses this anyway.
And Google started doing something which is really great, and Microsoft does this too. In fact, I love it on the Microsoft account, where you have to have the app, the Microsoft app on Authenticator app on your phone, but then instead of giving you a six-digit number, it'll pop up a notification saying you're trying to log in. Sometimes even before you enter the password, you just give it the email and say you're trying to log in, and you say yes. And then it does a funny thing. It says, okay, there's a two-digit number on your screen. Which of the four two-digit numbers on this screen is that? So you verify you're looking at your screen, and then it logs you in without a password. I think that's more secure. I know Duo Security uses that. Google has started using that. Even more secure probably than an authenticator program, because you have to physically have the phone. It's not an SMS. And it's not even a secret number in an authenticator app. It's actually direct communication.
It's like a key fob.
Yeah. I use a YubiKey for my Google account. That's the one I don't want to lose. So actually, that's really a pain. But you also feel like they'd have to steal my YubiKey to get into my Google account. Let's take a little break. We're talking high tech, the week's tech news on Twit. We had a fun week on Twit, actually. Do we have the promo we made? Here's a look at what you might have missed if you missed anything this week.
Previously on Twit.
The Falcon Heavy, largest rocket ever made, launched successfully today. And this is live footage. Watch this. from the Roadster floating in Earth orbit right now.
Oh, you're kidding.
In space. This is, I'm not making this up, but you think, you'd think I was.
You guys are having fun over there.
The new screensavers.
We have the Apple HomePod. Apple's saying, no, no, don't think of it as a Siri device. It's not a competitor to the Amazon Echo. It's a speaker. I want to make sure people don't buy this thinking, I'm getting the last stereo speaker I'll never need to buy. Mm-hmm. Apple's almost positioning it that way. Like, these are so good with computational audio, and it just isn't.
Know-how.
Flying FPV is...
Oh, that's cool.
Oh, my goodness.
That would help me fly better.
Good luck, Megan.
Okay, let's go get Megan.
Let's go.
Oh, no. Oh, no. Oh,
that's what all of my drone flights look like.
This week in Google.
Oh, no. John Perry Barlow has passed.
Yes.
Oh, no.
Oh, yes. I'm sorry.
Oh, no. That makes me so sad.
He'd been
sad.
Ill for quite some time. John Perry Barlow, he was a Grateful Dead lyricist.
One of the great gentlemen of the open internet
age. A classy guy, a Montana rancher who also helped founded the Electronic Frontier Foundation and did so much to promote the free internet.
We are creating a world where anyone, anywhere, may express his or her beliefs, no matter how singular, without fear of being coerced into silence or conformity.
We'll miss you, Perry. John Perry Barlow. Really great guy. Our show today brought to you by my doorbell, my Ring video doorbell. I actually turned the sound on my iPad because all morning long it was going off, and then nobody has entered the house in the last few minutes, so I didn't get the ding dong. This is so cool. On your phone, on your tablet, no matter where you are, anywhere in the world, you can hear somebody at your front door. You can hear somebody ring your doorbell, and you can talk to them. You can see them, and you can talk to them. And now Ring has expanded their offerings to the Ring Floodlight and the Spotlight Cam, so you can build a ring of security around your entire property. The Ring video doorbell, the floodlight. The idea of the Floodlight Cam is it's basically the same as the Ring video doorbell without the doorbell. It is those motion-activated lights you've seen, but attached to it is a high-def camera and a speaker and a microphone and a big alarm, 110 decibel alarm, so that you can, it's pretty cool. You can see anybody in your backyard, in your side yard, wherever you put the camera. You can speak to them. You can chase them off if they don't leave because you tell them to. You play that alarm. It'll definitely scare them off. Ring really works. All you have to do is go to twitter.com/ring and look at the videos that they post from the Ring video doorbell of people. It's got a night camera. This guy thinks he's breaking into the truck. And so he triggered the siren watch on the floodlight cam as the guy gets in and run, run. I should play the sound because it's just, he's that scared the hell. That's it.
Get out of here. Never come back.
Get out of here. Never come back. He said, I love what? Sometimes, the videos are surprising. It looks like an Eagles fan here, celebrating their Super Bowl victory. Go to twitter.com/ring. Yes. If you want to see some of these amazing videos, here's some guys who are about to rob a house. They literally notice the Ring camera, see the guy pointing to it, and they say, yeah, maybe not this house. We'll go next door. I love my Ring. I love the floodlight cams. And now we've got a great deal. The Ring of Security kit includes a Ring video doorbell, your choice of either one, two, or three floodlight cams. You get up to $150 off on a Ring of Security kit. Ring lets you see and speak to intruders from your smartphone, from anywhere, and you can even share video clips with neighbors using the Ring app. This is a really kind of a neighborhood watch system that works, that really works. Ring.com/twit for the Ring of Security kit. Save up to $150. You got to get this. Ring.com/twit. And if you already have it, get it for a family member. They're going to love you forever. Ring.com/twit. This is one IoT device you really want. I love looking at these videos on the Twitter feed. Oh, crooks. They'll never learn. They'll never learn. I love them. All right. I am a little perturbed about this, but I wanted to know what you think. Google has announced that starting in July, if you are a website and you're not secure. You're not HTTPS. You're not using TLS encryption. You will be labeled in Chrome not secure. Now, twit.tv is, of course, HTTPS. And we did that because Google even said we were going to improve your search results. But I have other sites that are not, that don't have logins. They don't have customer accounts on there. I see no reason for them to be secure. And yet, I don't want to be branded insecure, even though what does security mean? If you go to visit the tech guy site, there's no login. What would security mean there? Is Google going too far there? This is going to start with Chrome 68.
So I thought they already do this because in my experience, mm-hmm. when I visit sites, Chrome gives me a warning saying that this thing is insecure. It's not protected by HTTPS. But
are you
what's the difference now?
A more, maybe you're using a beta version of Chrome?
I think so.
If it's a site that's asking for information, like has form fields and stuff, I think you'll get that alert if it's not secure.
Oh, but this, yeah. But, so let me go to Tech Guy Labs, which is our radio show site on Chrome. This is not this is just an HTTP site. Yeah, you don't get any warning, and the and the bar at the top doesn't say insecure site. Okay. Yeah, it should say insecure if you're banking or buying something, but that's the point is that Google is going to start branding sites like the radio show site, and it's by the way not cheap because I have to. It's not merely going out and getting a certificate. The site is not designed to be HTTPS. Mm. It's a few years old. I'm going to have to go back and recode much of the site to support secure browsing, or I'm going to get branded not secure, as if it matters when you're visiting a read-only site.
Right, right. Does it matter if it's even branded? Because, it's not going to matter to the user. But go ahead, Ed.
Well, but here's the thing. What you're saying there, Leo, is that the billions of people who use the internet can be trusted to decide, oh, okay, this site doesn't need to be secure, but this one does need to be secure. And that's right. The problem. When you don't have HTTP, and I used to feel the way that you did. I used to feel this was a burden on people like me. I had to go back and redo a couple of websites also. But If you have a system that's bifurcated like that, then you've put an onus on people to make decisions that they're not capable of making. And so what Google has done, and I agree with them, and I think Microsoft is doing the same thing with versions of Edge that are coming out, is to basically say, look, HTTPS everywhere, because that way you don't have to think, oh, does this site need to be HTTPS? You just say, make it everywhere, and then you don't have to make a trust decision. And every time you can eliminate the need for people to make a trust decision, you eliminate the possibility that someone will make the wrong trust decision.
Mm-hmm. For sure. Yeah. Like, Leo, you have enough experience like helping people with the tech guy show and everything. Like,
I just don't want to do it. That's the thing
you're fixing. Yeah.
And there is an argument that if your site is not secure, you could do a man in the middle. So somebody could do a man in the middle on Tech Guy Labs and ask for credentials. Mm-hmm. People would think they're on Tech Guy Labs, and then thinking it's Leo, I can trust him, give them something that they shouldn't be. So I do understand that. I just feel like it's a bit of a burden.
Doesn't it kind of remind you of when Steve Jobs said the iPhone's not going to support Flash?
Yes.
And said, screw Flash. It's got to die. It's got to go.
Very
and
much
it
like
forced
that.
Everybody to stop using Flash. So I guess it's kind of doing a similar thing with HTTPS.
It helped that everybody hated Flash. So, yeah.
It would be nice to have I once interviewed Vint Cerf, the father of the net, and I said, if you were to redesign TCP/IP, knowing what you know now, is there something you'd do differently? He said, yes. So I would make it secure. I would build in encryption. Right. So, the world would be a better place if it's HTTPS everywhere. On my WordPress blog, I don't have the problem. It's just a checkbox on WordPress.com, and so I have that there. And a lot of the sites I use, there's really only this one site, this old tech guy site. But I fear it's going to cost me tens of thousands of dollars to go back, get that site recoded.
Just sell one of your 5 Teslas. And
I bought those things. They're expensive. By the way, very little resale money value on Teslas. They go, they depreciate really quick.
Wow.
I don't know why.
Where's that used Tesla market? I need that.
Yeah.
I think the opposite.
Maybe not. I don't know. I was just assuming that. I just, because I don't want to sell it. I do know I pay. This does not make sense. I pay more for insurance on the Tesla. My deductible is $5,000 because the insurance company said, "Are you going to ever use autopilot?" And I said, "Well, yeah."
Oh.
And in my opinion,
you gotta lie, man. What are you doing?
Yeah.
Well, in my opinion, that's better. I'm less likely to have a crash using autopilot. I mean, I'm not going to snooze while I'm using autopilot. I'm not going to drive home drunk.
So insurance companies are paid to have opinions that are more accurate than yours.
Than mine. I know. I have heard otherwise, though, that some insurance companies will give you a discount if you use autopilot. And ultimately, won't self-driving cars be better for insurance? I thought. Maybe not. Maybe not.
You'd think so. But yeah, we're still trying to figure out like who's to blame if there's an accident or anything. I do wonder if insurance companies will be smart enough to tell, like, if your car has all these sensors and can, you know, keep you in the lane, things like that. Do you get a deduction or do you get, like, a lower rate because of that?
I should. Yeah. I've stayed out of accidents because it sees a car that, I mean, I haven't rear-ended people that I might have because the car says, wait a minute, you're closing on that car too fast. It beeps. It pretensions the seatbelts. It starts braking. It does all sorts of stuff that prevent me from hitting that guy. Mm-hmm. I feel like that should give me a discount, but no. No.
But if somebody slams into you and takes out the front of your car, replacing all of that.
Oh, that's expensive.
Electronics is expensive. Right. So, and you know, that's.
Maybe that's why it's an expensive car I pay.
It's an expensive car. Yeah. That's the problem.
All right. Enough ranting. I'm ranting about the world is. I'm mad. I tell you. So Microsoft's going to do the same thing with Edge and Internet Explorer. They're going to start a warning. I think they said this a year ago. I mean, mm-hmm. They've given us some warning about this.
Does anyone use Safari anymore on the desktops?
I think Mac users, you're sitting there with the hotshot new MacBook. Don't you use Safari? It's better battery life.
Sometimes I use Safari when I'm forced to. Like there's a certain website that only works with Safari, but like the Apple earnings.
I'm using, like, believe it or not, Ed, you'll be proud of me. Yeah, the Apple earnings. They won't stream anything if you're not using Safari. Yeah. Ed, you'll be proud of me. I'm using Edge right now.
It's a very good browser. Mm-hmm. And one reason that, you know, there's an interesting story this week or last week, Slack, right? Which said they're only supporting Chrome.
What?
In the browser. Surprising. You didn't hear about that? I should have put it in the show notes. Slack officially only supports Chrome. And this is one of the reasons I have a MacBook Pro next to me here. I use Safari on it. I have several Windows 10 machines here. I use Edge on them because that's the browser that was designed for use with the operating system. And both of those have a usage share of about 25%,
right.
20-25% in their respective segments. But there's something really important about that 20-25% is that it keeps us from having yet another monoculture. You know?
Yes.
And the people who screamed and yelled about it correctly, as it turns out, about the Windows monoculture are distressingly silent about the Google Chrome monoculture.
Right.
And I run into so many sites that say, you know, this site best viewed in Chrome basically is what they're saying. And that's exactly what Slack did. And it drives me nuts.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. It's crazy. Like Chrome is a crazy piece of software now too. Like you just go look at your resource manager or whatever. Yeah. For some reason, Chrome will be using gigabytes of, RAM for no reason. Like, It is pretty crazy. I've been using the new Firefox, and they rebuilt that engine. It's actually pretty great and really not too memory intensive either.
So Slack is a little bit of a different story because it has apps. So you don't have to use the browser. Do they have an app for the desktop? Yeah, they have an app for the desktop.
Yeah.
So they do give you an option to use the Slack app. This is only if you're just going to use a browser.
But the point is, if you're going to deliver a service that is designed to run in a browser, then
make it run in browsers.
Make it run in any browser, any modern standards compliant browser. Microsoft with Edge, Mozilla with Firefox, Google with Chrome, and even Opera with Vivaldi. Is that what they're calling it now? all of those organizations have spent many, many tens of thousands of developer years making their product standards compliant. And it's just, it's laziness, and it's bad for the world, for the makers of services to say, sorry, we're only going to support one browser. We're not going to do the work of ensuring that we're supporting the standards. And what you wind up with is, in fact, that Chrome introduces a new feature and everyone says, oh, Chrome has a new feature. That's a standard. It's not.
Right.
It's a Chrome feature.
Well, and Internet Explorer was for years, right, the standard that people wrote to. I tell you, people who do web front ends hate that there is not a they want a monoculture. They hate it. They have to develop for every browser a unique, you know, stuff.
But that's not true anymore. That used to be true with Internet Explorer, and now there are good, solid, recognized standards around. You can do, and it's very, very simple. Feature detection. That's all you have to do. Does this browser support this feature? No. Then change your path. You don't have to do entire branches of code to support a different browser because it's different. They all did the work to support the W3C standards. And yet what's happening is that Chrome is becoming the new Internet Explorer.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Dominant, totally dominant. I'm completely with you, Ed. A monoculture is bad for bananas, and it's bad for browsers. and by the way, banana crisis coming soon. Do you like bananas? You better enjoy all the bananas you can right now, because there's a banana blight.
Yeah.
Well, the amazing story is there was one. And the problem is it gets in the ground. Where did I read this? Did you read it too, right? It gets in the ground. And initially banana growers, because there was only one strain everybody used, they would move their plantation. But eventually everywhere in the world had this bug. But then some guy found one new banana strain that was immune. So they planted that everywhere. And now it's getting bit by the bug.
That's all I ever eat for breakfast is bananas.
I knew that about you, Brian.
God.
Now, did you know this? What a shock. We've all been talking about the Pixel 2 XL and how it had a secret hidden chip in the Pixel 2 that was a visual core that Google didn't even turn on initially. And then they turned it on with Android 8.1 and suddenly your HDR pictures were better than ever. Except Ron Amadio said Google sent along a note saying the Pixel visual core is actually not used by the camera app.
Bunch what? Of nerds. You're all wrong.
What? Did you know that, Brian?
No, I didn't know any of this stuff.
This was like a big deal. I kept saying, oh, this camera, it's so good. You know why? It has a dedicated DSP, and they hit it in the phone, and nothing used. Well, it turns out the first apps that are going to use it are not Google, but Instagram, Snapchat, and WhatsApp. In the developer preview of Android 8.1, and Ron, like me, like everybody else, we thought, oh, that visual core, that's being used right by Google's app.
It's to run ads, geek folklore. Not to suck up the battery so much.
Geek folklore.
Yeah. But why? Why didn't they use their own thing?
I don't know.
What's going on?
I don't know. Come on, Google.
I feel like every tech company, I look at what they're doing, and I'm just shaking my head. Like, it's some dumb thing, basically.
You think they know something that we don't? Is that it, Devendra? Like, if we had perfect information, we'd do exactly the same dumb thing they're doing?
I mean, I don't know why they'd build something and not use it, because it costs money to put
all
that thing
the
in the bones. Yeah.
Look at Google's Messenger strategy for Android.
Oh, yeah.
Explain that to me, Google.
I think they're very bad at products. Yeah.
Well, there may be, because now one of the Android blogs looked at the source code of the upcoming Google Messages app. And it's going to have a desktop. It may have a desktop component finally, which would finally at least. I mean, the reason I keep using Hangouts is because I can use Hangouts on the desktop, and on my phone. And if I have Hangouts enabled, I have multiple phones. This is an unusual use case, but I think all of us share this problem. Hangouts will mean that I can get that message everywhere, but Google's Messages doesn't work that way. And then. But it supports RCS, which is a new standard that Google would love the carriers to adopt. The carriers say, screw you, Google. And so they have that. Then there's Allo.
Which nobody uses.
Which nobody uses because it doesn't support SMS. And then, I mean, it's But I feel like it might be because they don't want to piss off the carriers. Google's done this before, right, with Android. They could have made better hardware, but they were afraid that the Android, that the people like Samsung, LG would pull out of the Android ecosystem.
Now they're like fighting harder on that.
Now they say we want to win. Great profile of Rick Osterloh, who is the he's now kind of even more important at Google. He's in charge of Google hardware. And Rick is a senior vice president of hardware, and now he will be running the Nest Group as well, which has been moved out of Alphabet and into adult supervision.
Which I think needs some help, Nest.
Yeah.
They haven't really done anything interesting in, like, say, 3 years or something.
It's been a while.
Yeah. This is Wired Magazine's profile. Boy, that's a big picture.
I met Rick. He's a nice guy.
Oh, crap. I'm running up against Wired's new paywall. No!
You got to pay $5 for a year.
Is that all it is? Is that what it is?
Yeah, something like that.
See, it's funny because I didn't even look. I just, on principle, I don't want to pay for that. It's only $5? That's not bad.
I assumed you're already subscribing, Leo, so.
To Wired? No, well.
To Wired in general, yeah.
Oh, if you subscribe to the magazine, you don't have to pay for it.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah,
because that hasn't been true for me. I've been a subscriber to the magazine, and they for the longest time they didn't give me access to the website. I guess I need to go look at it again, maybe figure out how to sign in. But I found it. The thing that I found annoying was that
$20
a month. Paying them.
$20 a year. $20 a year. My bad.
Sorry.
Yeah.
It's still peanuts.
$5 a quarter. I pay for a subscription to the magazine, but the website, at least for a while, it was on a different system. Maybe I'll go back and look at it again.
Yeah, it looks like it is. There's the digital only subscription, which gives you unlimited access to Wired, ad free browsing, a print subscription as well, which I don't want because I've got. You know, I'm good. I have texture. I don't need it.
Is this going to work for them, you think? I mean, the New Yorker has a paywall, right?
Yeah, but I subscribe to the New Yorker, so I don't care. Yeah. But you're right. I think this is a bad idea in general. But I have to say, Wired Online has really beefed up their content. And they've branched out a little bit. They're doing a lot of coverage of other stuff besides pure tech stuff.
Yeah, I mean, as a person who used to work there, I feel like they used to do a lot of aggregation and not so much original content. But I think there's more of a focus on the original stuff now.
Like, here's an article, why it's almost impossible to do a quintuple jump in skating. So that's kind of cool. I don't think they're aggregating much at all anymore. I think they've got a lot of original content. It's probably very expensive. They only want $20, so you're right. I'm going to pay for it now. I pay for a lot. I pay for Paul Theroux. I mean, I should pay for this.
Well, and this is another problem that, you know, you talk about the conversation that you had with Vince Cerf. I think if we could all go back to the beginning of the web and redesign it, we would redesign it so that it could be monetized in some way other than really crappy banner ads and popovers and autoplay videos and things like that. We have become so accustomed to everything being free that the knee jerk reaction is I'm not paying for anything now. The good news is that sites like the New York Times and the Washington Post seem to be doing very well.
Boy, the New York Times.
Encouraging.
Congratulations. Yep. What did they say? Almost $1 billion in subscription fees?
Yeah, that sounds about right.
That's exciting. I mean, that means people value good journalism. I'm sure the Post is doing equally well under the able helming of Jeff Bezos.
Yeah. And you get a discount with your Prime, too. Yeah.
It's definitely good news when we're more supported by subscriptions than advertisements. Although, I forget how much is advertising for revenue, but
probably
$1 billion is significant. So.
Yeah. I think it was $900.
Well, and then there's sites like talkingpointsmemo.com, Josh Marshall's site, where they have sort of a hybrid model there, and you can read anything you want for free, but if you subscribe, I think for $50 a year, you get a site that is considerably less annoying. It doesn't have those ads. You get you still get a few ads, but most of the ads are they're pretty clean, they're pretty good, and the site is much easier to navigate. And ultimately, I've come down to I now pay, geez, 10 or 15 different publications precisely because I want to encourage that kind of business model, and I actively stay away from sites that are. That don't have any kind of option like that. CNN has autoplay videos on every single page. And so if I see a CNN link,
you're not going to go twice. There. Yeah.
Click it. Yeah. I think twice.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I mean, it's a dangerous thing. Like, there are some tech sites that I think go really, really overboard with, like, the autoplay video and the sound. That's the thing. Like, I'm okay with autoplay video, but the sound. Oh, man. It's tough, but I honestly don't know. Like, I do think there was something noble about the idea of, like, having this free, platform for information. And I wonder, like, if we started monetizing it earlier in a very efficient way, would that have, like, slowed any of the innovation down or anything? Like,
do you think micro some sort of micropayments was what we needed? Is that the solution that should have been implemented?
Yeah.
I mean, it's all moot now because we didn't do it. but clearly there's a problem. I mean, I don't know what the percentage of people using ad blockers is now. I would say the percentage of people using ad blockers who listen to this show is very high.
Very high.
I mean, it's sad that that's become a general recommendation that we have to use an ad blocker now, because otherwise your battery gets sucked by these,
and you're insecure,
these ad trackers and everything.
Yeah.
Malware.
Even YouTube was serving up malware in ads on YouTube.
Which is not their intention, but that's just how advertising networks work.
Because they're automatic.
Yeah. We're all kind of in a bad situation where you just have to block ads.
And yet, I as much or maybe more than anybody believe that you need to monetize great content. It needs to be paid for. I know how much we have a payroll in excess of $1 million a year. That's not coming. I can't pay that. It can't come out of my pocket. So so let me do an ad.
Buy fewer Teslas, Leo.
Don't block us, guys.
That's, people say that all the time. Leo, if you took less time off, if you didn't buy stuff, you could have more shows. It's like, I'm not going to give up my life so that you, I mean, that doesn't make sense.
True.
Please say yes. You know what I say? I say, no, that all comes from, I make a lot of money on the radio show. This doesn't come out of Twit. It comes out of the radio show. I don't know. I could make less money. Oh, look, my doorbell's finally ringing. I left that on hoping it would, but we've already done the ring ad. But I think it's not unreasonable, no matter what the business is. Yes, I know. Now the doorbell is ringing, I'm going to turn this off. It's not unreasonable, no matter what the business, to say, look, it's fair for a business to have to pay its bills. I don't care if it's Google or Facebook, you got to pay the bills. Now, I may not agree with how Facebook monetizes, but I understand it needs to monetize. And I see people all the time who want to use these services for free. And I say that I think you're free riding on something. It's a service that costs money. You're free riding. I think that's unethical. So anyway, I just paid for Wired. $20. It was worth it.
There you go.
So wrote down your credit card number when you were typing it.
Did you?
Yep.
So it's happened.
Buy me a Tesla.
Okay. Go ahead. Good luck. I don't think that the limit on that.
There's your episode title.
Thanks for buying me the Tesla. Our show today brought to you by FreshBooks. Actually, I used FreshBooks when they first started out in the mid-2000s. To do invoices. I hated doing invoicing. If you're, if you have what do they call it? A side gig. If you have a side hustle, a passion project, if you're a freelancer, that you're doing something you love. I love doing what I was doing. I was going up to Canada and doing a call for help up there. But the thing I hated was the bookkeeping, the paperwork. At the end of the month, I'd have to send out bills. But you find out if you don't do that part, you don't get paid. And that is kind of important. So FreshBooks saved my life in that respect. I was able to create professional-looking invoices quickly. FreshBooks invoices have a very nice feature, a pay me button on there. It turns out your clients will pay you faster if you make it easier for them. You can all of a sudden, just by using FreshBooks, accept credit card payments directly from the invoice, so you don't have to you know, get checks mailed to you and wait in line at the bank to deposit them. You don't have to chase clients for payments. In fact, it turns out because of this, because you can accept credit cards, there's a pay me button, you'll get paid on average twice as fast. Plus, FreshBooks, by virtue of doing the invoices, the accounts receivable, you track expenses, they're actually doing your books for you. You can go to the FreshBooks dashboard, this new redesigned dashboard is great, and know at any moment as a freelancer whether you're making money. Are you making a profit? And when tax season comes around, it's just a month off now, you'll be ready. You'll have all the reports you need to do your taxes effectively and quickly and easily. You can create proposals now in FreshBooks. They always are adding new features. This is something they never had when I was using it, with rich text content, images, customizable sections. They make it easy to bill for time by client, by project. You can even have different costs for different projects. They automatically connect to your bank account and update expenses from the bank account daily. So it's a dashboard to your entire financial life. Take a picture of a receipt, upload it. FreshBooks will do the rest. Put it right in there. From payment reminders to late fees, you can automate as much as you want or as little as you want. Get back to doing what you love. Make that side hustle a full-time gig with FreshBooks. Make this year your most productive year yet. You'll be ready when tax time comes along, and you'll be set up for success when you use FreshBooks. Try it free for 30 days. FreshBooks.com/twit. Enter This Week in Tech, if you would, when they ask you, how did you hear about us? That great support team in Canada, really nice people. FreshBooks.com/twit. You know who's not making money anymore on ads? Logan Paul. Google has pulled his ad revenue because even after the suicide video, this is a YouTube star who appalled everybody by showing a dead body from the Japanese, you know, that suicide forest. Then apparently he's been doing more bad stuff.
To dead bodies of animals.
No, really?
Yeah, he's tasing a dead hamster or something.
Oh, my God. What is wrong with you?
Is it a dead rat or a dead hamster? Oh, one of those.
Firing a rifle at dead rats or something. Oh. Just throw this guy into a volcano and live stream it.
That is the ultimate conclusion. Yeah.
Live stream it. Was he the guy who encouraged his followers to eat Tide Pods? That's where that started.
Too. Yeah,
that's horrible.
So his audience is like, how old are
they? They're impressionable 14-year-olds.
Oh,
that's
sad. Yeah, how old is he?
I don't know.
I think he's like
early
20s.
Yeah, he's not very old.
Him and his brother and his younger brother has like a really young following too. It's really, really weird. I don't know.
Social Blade, which does predicts how much people make on YouTube, estimates he earns more than a million a month in ad revenue. So this is a big... Now, it's a temporary ban, but nevertheless, you take away $1.2 million a month from somebody, they're going to sit up and take notice. At the same time, I feel like YouTube is completely complicit in this. That this is how you succeed on YouTube, by getting increasingly outrageous, right?
I mean, it's like their hands have been caught in the cookie jar, so they have to act on it now, right? Like that they've been supporting Logan Paul for this long, and suddenly there's a PR nightmare, and they have to do something, which is pull the ads.
It's PR, and it's temporary, because YouTube gets a big cut of that. We don't know how much, but if Logan's making, you know, a million, they're probably making two or three.
Yeah, and it's strange that it's a temporary suspension. Like, so when do you decide to bring him back if he's teasing dead rats and showing dead bodies on the internet?
Yuck.
It's just
yuck.
Don't really get how you come back from that. But advertising.
There was
advertising.
Something very similar that happened a few months ago, where there was a group of YouTube, not stars, but content producers, let's call them, who were doing it, and mostly parents doing funny things with their kids making them edgier and edgier, and it turned out that they were rewarding engagement from an audience of pedophiles, basically.
Oh, great.
So then all of a sudden, what happened was that Google just automatically shut off the ad revenue spigot for all of these content creators with no warning. So they had been making $100,000 or more a month each. And then all of a sudden, with no warning, Google says, sorry, your channel's dead. You're going to zero. And, you know, we're back to, this is a theme that mm-hmm. has come up again and again. This was completely predictable.
Yeah.
Anybody who sat down and thought about the impact of algorithms on human behavior and rewarded by big money could have just drawn the little trend line there and said, here's where it ends. Well, and then if you think about that at the beginning, these problems, you're prepared to deal with these problems. But instead, we just seem to be going over and over again to the, I had no idea how that happened. We'll shut him down until we figure it out. And it just, the fact that it just keeps happening is disturbing.
This is what happens in TV too, though, right? There, sensationalism breeds sensationalism because what was once sensational is no longer driving traffic. So you have to ramp it up, amp it up. Mm-hmm. The only difference is, I think it's actually advertisers that keep the lid on that and broadcast anyway, because there's only so far you can go. Although mm-hmm. over time, we certainly have gotten more and more sensationalistic. I remember more.
And there is the FCC, and there's a lot of like standards groups and things like that. Yeah, and yeah. YouTube is like just the Wild West.
Nobody's putting any pressure on YouTube at all, really.
You know, yeah. Recently I was thinking to myself, so people are eating Tide Pods. This guy's shooting tasers at rats. And some lady just flushed her hamster down the toilet.
That's the saddest story I ever saw in my life.
On the airplane. And I thought, is the world just ending right now?
This is the end times.
It's all led to this. It's the year 2018 and all this is happening at the same time. I just, it was really bleak. Yeah.
So this is nature's response, I can't blame it too. So.
We are in the darkest timeline, I think.
Yeah.
Yeah, something happened. We got sucked into the wrong timeline. Can I go back?
I blame the Large Hadron Collider. I will always blame it.
The Higgs boson. Right. We should never have sought the Higgs. So I think this still feels like a bogus story about
it sounds like a fake news story, right?
It doesn't sound possible. Spirit Airlines, among other airlines, have been cracking down on companion animals. A lot of people bringing animals of all kinds on because they're nervous flyers or whatever. A college kid brought her hamster on. Apparently, a flight attendant who'd been having a bad day told her to flush her emotional support hamster down the toilet, and the girl, for some reason, did it.
No loyalty today.
It feels like this is a fake news story.
First of all,
I can't believe that this is true in any aspect.
I don't believe for a second that an employee told her to flush the hamster down the toilet.
She's trying to sue now, right?
I mean, that's ridiculous. For one thing, that would probably clog the toilet. So from a most practical point of view, no one's ever going to tell someone to do that on a plane, right? But she obviously flushed her hamster down the toilet, and she wants to blame somebody else and get some money out of it. She asked Spirit twice
whether she could bring Pebbles on the plane. Pebbles is the hamster.
Right.
Just in case you're confused. And the Spirit said twice, she checked with the airline. She brought along paperwork that said this is an emotional support animal. But another employee said you can't bring it on board. She got on the plane. She told the Miami Herald she was hours from friends who could help, wasn't able to rent a car. Taking a Greyhound bus would take days. So the Spirit animal suggested that she let Pebbles go outside or flush her down the toilet. I guess they hadn't taken off yet. So she thought it'd be inhumane to let the animal outside.
That's inhumane.
So she drowned it in a toilet. Yeah.
This has got to be fake news. By the way, good news. She's got a replacement rodent. I'm sorry. It has nothing to do with tech, but you brought it up, and I got to mention it because it can't be real. We are in some weird timeline. I just don't understand it. Then there's the story. And by the way, tell Nellie Bowles I love her.
She's good.
She's great. Yeah. In fact, if you could just tell her how nice it is up here.
Will do.
She could come up sometime. Maybe you could come up together.
Sure.
She's in the San Francisco office, right, at the New York Times?
Yeah, she could hitch a ride.
She could just hitch a ride with you. Yeah. Great story about, and this is another weird one. Early Facebook and Google employees have formed a coalition to fight the ill effect of Facebook and Google. The Center for Humane Technology plans an anti-tech addiction lobbying effort. These guys apparently felt guilty. They funded a campaign called The Truth About Tech with $7 million plus $50 million in donated media and airtime from who? Comcast, of course.
The Truth About Tech.
Watch more TV. Don't use your computer. And DirecTV. Former in-house ethicist at Google, Tristan Harris, said, "We were on the inside. We know what the companies measure. We know how they talk. We know how the engineering works. They're bad, bad people." No, I added that part. Is this weird?
So to back up, so this whole conversation about addiction started out with an Apple investor or two Apple investors who are
yes,
like billion-dollar something investors saying that there's an addiction issue with smartphones and children.
Apple should look into
right?
this
and
do something
look
about
into
it.
This. Yeah.
Apple agreed.
Yeah, but sure, these are like some rich investors, but like, why are we talking about this now? Hasn't this been an issue for a while? Or also, like, is there a reason that this is more prominent or more of a serious issue now than before? That's kind of my question. Like, well, like it seems like addiction should have been something that we should have been talking about for like the past decade.
Chamath Palihapitiya, who was an early employee at Facebook and is now a venture capitalist. Gee, I wonder where the money came from. said that Facebook is ripping apart the social fabric of how society works. Now that I got mine.
it's not just addiction, though.
It didn't just start with the Apple shareholders. Before then, who was it? Was it Sean Fanning who said, "I see what Facebook's doing to children, and it's just terrible"? I mean, this has been going on for a year now.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Yeah, the elections, like, I'm not surprised. Like, and now is the time where we're seeing the reckoning of big tech on society. So, yeah,
and
this is the response.
No one's really offering a great solution, like, among the tech companies, right? So parental controls on both Apple and Android are still not that great, right? They don't really control very many features of the phone to regulate a kid's usage of the phones. I don't really feel like there's – I mean, there's a conversation, but there's no great solutions coming out of this.
Not Sean Fanning. Sean Parker.
Oh, Sean Parker, yeah.
Said, "God only knows what it's doing to our children's brains." God only knows. God doesn't know. Tim Cook said he wouldn't let his nephew on social media. Steve Jobs famously wouldn't let his kids have iPads.
Yeah. Right.
But, you know, this is what we were talking about with YouTube and the algorithms, right? Like, they weren't thinking about this. They just wanted to build the biggest video platform in the world and not think about the consequences. So I think there's definitely room for a group that maybe does some of that, or at least, you know, raises questions that, you know, having covered startups for a long time, the tech companies do not ask some of these questions. They just want the numbers. They want the users, and they want the stats. They don't care how it's being used. Yeah.
And for a long time, I poo-pooed the notion of internet addiction. I thought that was just, techno panic and so forth. But I think it's pretty clear. You see people walking around, walking into traffic, looking at their phone all the time. You see families at a restaurant. Go to a restaurant sometime and see. Nobody's talking to each other. They're all looking at their phone the whole time. So it clearly there is something going on. And it's also clear that these companies are willing to, in effect, weaponize their engagement strategies. Facebook, of course, and others, where they get the data. They know what makes people spend more time on the news feed. Well, whatever that is, let's up that. Let's turn that knob up. And as a result, you get something that is literally addictive.
Mm-hmm. Well, and you just nailed it. You just nailed it right there. This is there is money to be made by amplifying the bad behavior. There is nothing but cost in regulating the bad behavior. You have a double whammy for any large tech company that tries to build the proper kind of parental controls and social controls into their software. Number one, it takes resources away, development resources away from the features that are making them all the money. So developers are a scarce resource. And then number two, it reduces engagement. It reduces the monetization opportunities. And so I think you're going to hear a lot of big tech companies paying lip service to all these things. I think Facebook has been particularly good about talking about all the wonderful things it's going to do. But from a pure economic standpoint, it's like, you know, it's like all the tax money that's coming back, or the repatriated profits that are coming back here. It's the underlying behavior can't change because the economic incentives are not changing.
Yeah, why would companies change that? They're not going to change that. Government's not going to regulate it. This isn't going to change.
It takes something big to happen, like the election, right? Like Mark Zuckerberg's big awakening happened after he realized that maybe a foreign power used his own, social network to trick the American public using the algorithms and technology that they spent so long building. And what was his solution, right? Is that he's going to do his job and pay attention as CEO, and also I guess make the timeline less influential too, which is really strange. So less news in the timeline because they don't know how to manage the accuracy of news in the timeline.
Have you guys seen the Android parental controls that came out pretty recently, like maybe a year ago? I think it was called Google Family Link or something. Mm. It's actually quite good because you can have very, very detailed controls of a kid's usage of the smartphone. You can turn it off at certain times, turn off the Wi-Fi, turn off the cellular, etc. But here's the caveat. The kid can turn off the parental controls once he turns 13. And that's the age when you don't want them to have unregulated access. And yeah, I asked Google about it, and they said, well, legally, people can start signing up for a Google account at the age 13. So at that point, we just graduate them from the parental controls program. and that's so they no longer need parental controls. But I'm thinking, like, once a kid turns 13 is when you want to turn on parental controls.
They're
so it's totally backwards.
And you got to stop them from the Tide Pods.
You probably remember, we've seen this all before. Remember, everybody was recommending, it was with the internet. And parents were buying filtering software to block the internet, and that was the big conversation 10, 15 years ago. How do I keep my teenager from seeing porn on the internet? And there was a teenager, his name was Bennett, I can't remember his last name, who created a site called Peacefire, and I just went to see, and still there, peacefire.org, they call it the world's largest distribution network for proxy sites to circumvent internet censorship, but it was really created to circumvent blockers.
Oh, wow. That site has not been updated since 1996.
No, it looks like it, right? In fact, they still have a blocking software FAQ.
Wow.
Yeah. How to get around cyber sitters, cyber patrol. And I used to tell parents, dude, this information is shared among every kid in high school.
Of course.
Don't think you're blocking anything. And I imagine it's the same today. Yeah, isn't this funny? It's still here. I imagine the same thing is going on with, these Bennett Hazelton, that's his name. These same things are going on with these parental controls on the Android phones.
And I think I read that it's really easy to find porn on YouTube too, right?
Really?
Can
you tell me how?
YouTube for kids. I think there was a story recently.
It's on the kids section.
Where parents were complaining that porn was getting uploaded to YouTube for kids. So
great.
A lot of problems.
Great. Yeah.
I mean, Tumblr, which is where a lot of like kids and teens are too, like that is it's a haven for porn. It's all crazy.
Twitter too, right? Twitter doesn't Twitter's free speech policy extends to adult content. Reddit, Instagram and Facebook have been very aggressive about preventing that. Twitter shows its first profit ever this quarter after 11 years and 7 months in operation and lots of losses. I love the Register. I just always show the Register headlines because they're so funny.
And
Jack
his photo.
In black, 12 years on, Twitter finally makes a profit from its fire hose of memes and misery. Mostly they made a profit because they cut costs. The costs at Twitter were so outrageous.
Right. So they're not growing the business. They're just cutting the business to cut costs.
You think their stock has gone up? Do you think they're trying to sell it?
Well, in fact, their stock was the only one that went up on a day when everything was collapsing. Their stock it was one of the lesser declines this week, but still everything was down like 2.5-3%, and Twitter was up 12%. You can only imagine they probably would have been up 20% if it hadn't been a completely down day for the market. But the real question to me with that is, were they cutting inefficiencies from the business, or were they simply just slashing and burning with the hope of getting, you know, a quarter or two to goose the stock price, because there's a big difference between those two things.
Twitter told investors in its quarterly report that it's reduced expenses by 28% year over year. That's got to be a slash and burn. You can't cut costs that much.
They lay off 28% of the staff or something?
Yeah, but you got to, that's a lot of stuff. $91 million profit. First time to have a net income for Twitter.
I mean, Vine probably cost a lot. When did that happen? When did they kill that, right?
Yeah, and Periscope is dying on the Vine, speaking of Vine. Another Twitter acquisition that hasn't been
nice.
Really... Yeah, they haven't put any money.
And that was also a gap profit also. They were actually, they didn't make it with the accounting
generally
tricks.
Accepted accounting practices. Yeah, so like real money. Wow.
Take it to the bank.
Wow. Let's talk about security in Adobe Flash Zero Day. It's like the old, good old days back in the wild. Adobe plans, I think, has Adobe patched it? I think they patched it.
Yes.
By now.
This week.
Yeah. Let's see. Oh, there's so many exciting hacks. Grammarly had a flawed Chrome extension that exposed user tokens to anybody interested. Samsung and Roku's smart TVs vulnerable to hacking. This one comes from an unusual source, Consumer Reports. Didn't know they were doing pen testing.
You know, it's kind of a troubling story because when you think about all the smart home stuff we're having right now, like internet-connected light bulbs, et cetera, you got to think, like, do they have security teams making sure that these things have robust security, or are they just making cool lights that turn on and off with Alexa or whatever?
Yeah.
And then you look at the TVs, and you would think that no one's going to hack a TV, but they could probably turn it into a botnet that takes something down, you know? So it's something to think about, right, for smart home stuff in general, that they're making cool products, but they probably don't have great security teams.
Yeah. I mean, it's particularly disturbing, like, after CES, because they're all announcing these whole home smart solutions too, right? LG has a whole new smart home thing. Samsung wants Bixby everywhere. And I'm talking to these companies, trying to ask them about security, and they don't really know. Like, they say, oh, yeah, we always care about security, but there isn't, like, extra attention being paid to this stuff.
So they tested five different proprietary... Let's see, they did the Samsung Tizen, the LG WebOS TV. They had a TCL TV, which uses Roku, Sony, which uses Android TV. And they have a new standard for privacy on these devices. And actually, I think maybe this isn't vulnerable to hacking is one issue, but they also looked at the fact that many of these devices phone home, that they keep track of what you watch. They're sending data back. And I think there's a lot of incentive in these manufacturers to collect data about viewing habits. There's some good money in that.
Because their profit margins on the hardware itself are
plummeting,
razor thin.
Yeah.
And they're just like the PC makers were 10 or 12 years ago. They're making nothing on the hardware. And so they would shovel software onto the device and then, you know, push people to buy it. And because that was where that's where they make the money. But, you know, here we are again with a technology that's rushing at us at the speed of an oncoming train. And it's the adoption curve is a hockey stick, and nobody's thinking about it. So the stuff that we're talking about with YouTube and Facebook and the social media now, let's come back in a year or two and we're going to be having put a pin in it right here. We're going to be having this talk about, wow, how come nobody was thinking about the impact of all these Internet of Things, you know, that are all the disaster that's happening with the Internet of Things devices out there. It's going to happen, and it's completely foreseeable. And yet.
Well, and collecting all this information is a security issue as well as a privacy issue, because in many cases they're transmitting the information insecurely, so somebody can intercept what you're watching on TV.
Yeah, it's not encrypted usually.
Yeah. They also found flaws in sets from TCL and Samsung that allowed researchers to turn the volume up. I mean, that's not the end of the world. Rapidly cycle through channels, open disturbing YouTube content. Uh-oh. Here comes Goatsy on your TV. or kick the TV off the Wi-Fi network. So Consumer Reports is actually doing a good job on this, and I guess they carry a lot of weight with consumers, and I think this might have some merit in at least getting these TV companies to pay attention.
But, you know, there's an interesting thing here that we're going to harken back to something we talked about an hour ago, which was about cars and the entertainment systems in cars and how, a car is going to last, assuming that you don't total it, it's going to last 10, 15, 20 years. And yet the embedded entertainment system in it is going to be the thing that was shipped with it. The same thing is true with TVs. TVs, you know, they might not last as long as they used to, but they still, there's no reason why a TV shouldn't last for 7, 8, 10 years. And, you know, I got rid of a TV last year that was about nine years old, and it had like an Android 2.0 smart TV system in it. And, that thing probably wasn't all that hackable because, you know, Android was so terrible back then. But the ones that are going out there now, the stuff is not going to be updated. These TV manufacturers have zero incentive to update the software on their devices and to make them more secure. And so what you're doing is you're dumping a bunch of stuff out there that's just going to be hideously insecure. And whoops, there it is.
Oh.
Is that your smart toothbrush that
I'm brushing my teeth.
I should hack to?
This show's been on so long, I feel like it's time to get up and brush my teeth. No, it's our sponsor. This is Quip.
Quip makes a toothbrush subscription. This cleans like a premium electric brush, like $25. It's the greatest thing because it does not have rechargeable. It just holds a AAA battery in there. It has a little strip on here. You can put it right on the mirror. They send you new brush heads automatically, so you don't every 3 months for $5, including free shipping worldwide. So you don't have to remember that. No charger, no wires, compact, light. It's affordable, and it does a great job of brushing your teeth. It's got little rubber bristles around the edge. It's got softer nylon bristles in the middle. Does that whole thing of reminding you to, 2 minutes and you'd move the quadrant every 30 seconds. This is Time Magazine. It's one of Time Magazine's best inventions of the year. It's Quip. I love this thing. Mm. Brush is $25. Starts at $25. Comes in 4 great colors. I love this. Patent pending. So, in short, it is time to get a fabulous electric toothbrush. You don't need to spend $100 or more. Have you reviewed this yet at the New York Times? You should. I'm going to get you one.
Does it send information about what you ate back to the
does
advertisers?
Not. There is no internet connection at all.
All right. I'll consider
it. Safe. I really like it. It's the new electric toothbrush with just the right amount of vibration and a slimmer design. It's easy to use, a fraction of the cost. Its 30-second pulses guide you to you brush right. They even have a guide that I learned from. I think this is actually pretty cool on how to brush your teeth in here. First of all, most toothbrush companies, in the ads, they show the toothpaste, they show a big thing and the little curl at the end of the Quip's not trying to get you to use more toothpaste. They say just put a little dab will do you, just a little pea-sized dollop on there, which is actually correct. They also say, and I did not know this, after you brush your teeth, don't rinse your mouth.
What?
Yes. My whole life, I've been rinsing my mouth. You know why? It's got fluoride, and you want the fluoride to sink it in your teeth. Are you rinsing after brushing?
Yeah, I'm always rinsing my mouth.
Stop, Brian. Look, it says right here in the healthy guide, brush twice a day, a.m. and p.m. Floss. You got to floss. Pea-sized paste. Brush gently. A lot of these toothbrushes, these expensive ones, are too aggressive. In fact, I was using one. My dentist said, stop. You're going to, the enamel is disappearing on your teeth. This is perfect. It's short strokes, every surface, all corners. Scrub your tongue, wash, not rinse. See, it says they're right there. But to get the full effect of your toothpaste, do not rinse your mouth, at least not for a little bit. Quip starts at just $25. But if you go to getquip.com/twit right now, you get your first refill pack free. When you purchase any Quip electric toothbrush, get your first refill pack free. Getquip.com getquip.com/twit. GETQUIP. Getquip.com/twit. We care about your oral health, people.
All right.
I'm going to put my quip away. This, don't let anybody else use this. Leo has used this now. I love how it comes in this thing. This is so great. And yeah, you get the toothpaste by mail. Very nice toothpaste. Very affordable.
You can polish the chrome on your Tesla.
Shut up on that. You're giving me such a hard time. You're just jealous in your Prius. You're just jealous.
I am.
I actually love my Tesla. I really do love my Tesla. It's a great car. I kind of secretly love Elon as well. I wish him well. I want him to succeed. And you know what? If he was looking for people to go to Mars and not come back, I'm your guy, Elon. I'll be your first Martian.
What are they saying in the chat room right now? I really
want to know. Talking about fluoride.
Spit and swallow. Fluoride is delicious. It's good for your teeth. Don't drink it. Sugar.
Send Leo to Mars.
Send Leo to Mars. Patreon's doing a Snapchat-like feed for its artists, a photo and video feed. Trying to maybe... They say it's not going to replace Instagram or Snapchat, but something extra that artists can do. It's an interesting... branching out for the crowdsourcing, crowdfunding network. I like Patreon. They've had some struggles. ESPN's going to do a new subscription app, $5 a month. It will have none of the sports you want.
Can we read Wired Magazine on it?
No. No, you can't do any. It's curling. Actually, I watched curling the other night, and I enjoyed it. It's quite dramatic.
Curling is great.
Curling is great. Yeah. I take it all back. So ESPN pays lots of money for rights to the NFL and the NBA and college football. They're not going to put that on their new service. ESPN Plus will have, quote, incremental thousands of hours of live programming, but nothing you can see on any other ESPN channel, which means not even curling. I mean, not nothing. What kind of weird stuff? Zimbabwean soccer matches. I don't know what it's going to be. It won't be anything.
Badminton.
Badminton. You know, don't knock badminton.
Waymo. It's not on. I can't watch it on ESPN. So, right. You know, thank right. goodness for this.
Curling, I'm telling you. Curling in 4K, you've never seen anything. So beautiful. It's a beautiful, beautiful sport. Waymo is settling with Uber. Remember, of course, that the lawsuit from Google's autonomous vehicle division, Waymo, claimed that a Uber employee... Whoa, it's an autoplay video. Stop it. I don't like you. That what was his name? Lewandowski, right?
Yeah.
Left Uber and took with him a bunch... I'm sorry, left Google and took with him a bunch of proprietary secrets, which he then handed over to Waymo. They've been going back and forth. One day of trial... One day, this is actually not that unusual, apparently. They just wanted to see if they had the guts to take it to the brink. Uber said, all right, all right. Waymo was asking for half a billion in stock. They got 430, I think, something like that.
234, I think.
Oh, is that all? I thought they got more than that.
Yeah. No. In fact, it was a, and.
Oh, you know what? It depends on, it's Uber stock, so it depends on what. The,
on its valuation.
On its valuation. So it could range from $153 million to $245 million on how you value Uber.
Right. But the interesting thing is that I think a lot of the employees who came over as part of the settlement are going to have their options wiped out because of the settlement.
Oh.
And so Uber's going to wind up making money on the deal.
Oh, my God.
It's at the expense of the
employees,
the acquisition, the people, the acquihires, capitalism. What are you going to do?
It's a win-win. It's like Equifax making money on its breach, which they did. And by the way, now that the Consumer Protection Board has been dismantled, that's it. No punishment. Nothing going on. Equifax just moves on, makes money, and moves on. I love this. In Bloomberg Technology, they're talking about the Waymo settlement. They interviewed two jurors who sounded disappointed. The trial ended so quickly. They were looking forward to to hearing from Anthony.
Not going to work.
Yeah, right. So they wanted to hear from Anthony Lewandowski. So that what that tells me is they had jurors who knew what was going on, and that's probably why Waymo settled. Oh, crap. These people know who Lewandowski is. We're in deep trouble. Hard to get a jury in Silicon Valley that doesn't know what's going on. Also, I think it's the new CEO at Uber, Dara Khosrowshahi, trying to settle old scores and move on.
Well, he's the new guy. He can. That's basically you bring him in. He doesn't have to take any. I mean this in a good way. He doesn't have to take any personal responsibility for the acts that caused the thing to happen. He can be the magnanimous one who says, in fact, that was the big statement that they wrote is, you know, we're going to do the right thing here. We're going to, you know, make sure that our companies can continue to work together, blah, 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 blah. And, you know, close the books on this unsavory chapter and let's look ahead.
Yeah. Do you think he's going to turn around Uber that he's going to put all this stuff behind him and the company?
I don't see how. I honestly don't see how. And it isn't the I'm not talking about the you know the horrible culture that they had there, but really just from a pure economic point of view, Uber, from my reading of their of the financials that I've seen, Uber has been a it's been losing money.
It's a money pit.
Because they've been charging far less than they need to charge to make a profit. But that was the way to cripple the taxi companies. Right. And the argument that you always got from people was, well, once self-driving cars come along, the costs
will make
drop
it up in volume
dramatically.
Yeah. We're losing money on every ride, but we'll make it up in volume.
Make it up in volume. But I think we already see from the pace of the technology
it is not proceeding.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah, it's not coming fast enough, and there's going to be a crunch at some point. A big financial crunch there, and the question will be: will it be before or after they go public?
Mm.
Do you guys still use Uber? Any of you?
No,
very rarely.
I use Lyft instead.
Yeah,
yeah.
I use Lyft, and I think from a consumer point of view, it's just a better app than Uber.
Yeah. Interesting.
Yeah, I mean,
I think consumers just think they're interchangeable, don't they?
I mean, it's a better interface to find where you are and that kind of thing. And adding tip is easier.
I just use Uber I really shouldn't. I know I'm not supposed to, and I feel bad, but it's inertia. I just have Uber set up, and it's got a credit card. I'll set up Lyft. I really should.
Yeah, just delete the Uber app. It's easy. But honestly, even Lyft and all these, taxi
they have the same
like
problem, right?
It's
they
the
have
same to, thing. They're undercutting pricing. I was in LA last year. It's crazy how cheap Lyft is compared to like a normal cab.
Right.
And who knows how long
which
this
means it's subsidized. Yeah. And you're not, as to your point.
Right. They have to compete with their pricing to compete with Uber, and Uber is pricing to undercut taxis. And so it's this big giant shell game. And when you pick up the shell, there's nothing underneath it, which is, I guess it's great. There's that theme again, but we're back to, I mean, it's like the original sin of the internet, right? Which is, you know, all this content is free. All these rides are dirt cheap, but at some point there's going to come a reckoning for this.
We've seen this over and over again. This is how companies establish a foothold in the market. Investors don't demand that they be profitable right away. That's kind of the Silicon Valley way. And the investors are really investing in this dream of the future, whether it's autonomous vehicles or, you know, one of the profit centers Uber could have come up with also is deliveries. They've got people driving around all the time. Mm-hmm. They could deliver, as they do, food. They could deliver packages for Amazon. They could do all sorts of things. Although, we talked last week about Amazon Health. This week, Amazon, according to the Wall Street Journal, says they're going to launch a delivery service to compete with FedEx. I was just waiting for this to happen. And UPS. This is going to be a business-to-business initially, just as Amazon Health is going to be for employees only initially. But you have to think, Bezos, one of the big costs for Amazon, especially with Amazon Prime, is delivery. They've been squeezing UPS and FedEx.
Yeah.
But at some point, they're just going to deal them out.
And every time you eliminate a middleman, you know, if FedEx and UPS need to make a profit in there. Amazon doesn't necessarily need to make a profit on shipping. If it becomes a component of the purchase process instead of a cost center, they drive a lot of cost out of there, but unfortunately they drive a lot of UPS and FedEx drivers out of business as well.
The Journal says Amazon plans to undercut UPS and FedEx on pricing. And, Amazon can lose money on this for 5 years while those companies bleed and eventually go out of business, and then, which is what Amazon's done all along with everybody. The test project launches in the next few weeks in Los Angeles with third-party merchants that sell goods on the Amazon website. But then they plan to expand the service to more cities and more people and eventually start delivering, picking up packages from businesses and shipping them to consumers. And I think it's just a matter of time before they say, we don't really need UPS and FedEx. We've got our own fleet of planes now. They now have ocean freight. and pretty soon Amazon's just going to own everything.
Have you guys tried that thing where you can let them into your house, that Amazon, I think it's called Key?
Yeah, no, nope. I wouldn't dare do that.
Yeah, it sounds creepy to me.
I don't like that idea. Especially because it's the Amazon's logistics drivers, and that's that new thing Amazon's doing where they basically pick up somebody on the street and say, would you bring this package to Leo? No, it's not that bad. But it's roughly the same model as Uber. Strange people with unmarked vehicles, some guy pulls up in a 2010 Chevy Impala and says, here's your package. It's a little scary, and that's the people who will have access to your house.
You know, it kind of reminds me, so recently, did you see the story about WAG, that dog walking app? this happened to a friend of mine. It made it to the news. She hired a dog walker, and she wasn't home, and they have a lockbox to let the dog walkers in and grab the dog. After the dog walker walked the dog, she came home, and she found the walker's wallet in her bed.
Oh, that's not good.
Under her sheets.
That's not good.
And it just made her wonder, what the hell is this guy doing in my bedroom on my bed? And why is his wallet here,
Under the sheets.
Yeah, under the sheets, nonetheless.
Yeah. He must have taken a nap.
He needed a nap.
Yeah.
Super creepy, So you got to think, when you let people into your home like that.
Well, they had all these technological things, like there's a camera and blah, blah, blah. Although somebody immediately showed that you could hack it. So that you'd go in, you'd drop off the package, your camera would get that, you would disable the camera, you'd go back out, and then 30 seconds later, the camera goes offline, you go back in, you rob the house, and you leave. And there's no proof because the camera got you bringing the package and leaving.
Right. Yeah.
Nice hack.
And someone in the chat
just... Put a piece of tape over the lock. Yeah.
Someone in the chat just asked me if the dog was in the bedroom. No, the dog was in the front in a crate.
The dog...
in the living room.
At least most dogs don't have wallets, so...
Yeah.
I think that's probably a safe bet. Yeah, Emmett...
This is one of those things we were talking about. You could see this problem coming from a mile away. Are we that dumb? Or, I don't know, is Amazon that willfully blind over this tech, not seeing where it could go wrong?
You don't get to be the richest man in the world without breaking some eggs.
Taking some risks, yeah.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, taking risks. I don't know what the eggs was about. Friends, we've come to the end of this show. We have many more stories we could talk about, but I know that you want to see ice dancing, Devendra, and I don't want to keep you from your Olympics, so we'll wrap this up. Devendra Hardawar, senior editor at Engadget, at Devendra on the Twitter. Thank you so much for being here.
And movie podcast at slashfilm.com.
Don't forget Slash Film. Absolutely. Yep. Slash Film is really... What are you talking about in the most recent episode?
Coming up, there's this crazy Korean action movie I'm forcing my co-hosts to see. It's called The Villainous. It's half of a really good movie and half not so good, but it's a lot of fun. And then, of course, we're going to be talking about Black Panther soon.
Yeah, and Oscars.
Oh, yeah, and Oscars
coming
yeah.
up. I just saw last night, Winston Churchill, The Darkest Hour. I was surprised. I've seen 4 Churchill movies this year. I don't know what it is, but this was the best one. This was good.
Very good.
Although it's Gary Oldman, you can kind of tell it's Gary Oldman, but okay, he did a good job.
And Gary Oldman doing the Gary Oldman, shouting and really acting.
Yeah. anyway, Slash Film, and it's a great blog too. If you want to, if you read the Slash Film blog, because there's a lot of news there and so forth. So, Filmcast is the podcast.
Yeah, we're right up there.
Yep, the Cloverfield Paradox. What'd you think?
It's not a good movie, but I had a lot of fun with it. It is really dumb.
It's so bad. Yeah. And I'm so really pissed off because the way they advertised it in a Super Bowl ad saying coming soon, and then they said another ad right after the Super Bowl. You had to watch it.
It's a baller move. Yeah.
Baller. That's the
only
word.
Way to save a bad movie, basically.
Yeah. Before the word gets out, watch it.
Yeah.
Because
don't let the reviewers see it.
Yeah. Yeah. Don't let the reviewers see it, whatever you do. That's Ed Bott from Santa Fe, New Mexico. It's always a pleasure to talk to you. Ed Bott report on ZDNet. Anything
you,
else
Leo.
You want to plug? You got a book coming out. I know, actually, one of your books is free right now on Amazon.
Well, I've got it. Really?
Wow. Your Windows 10 book is somebody said in the chat room, is free on Amazon right now.
Well,
that doesn't mean you get no money. Actually, it does.
Go get it.
Yeah.
I have a series of ebooks that I did for Microsoft Press. So it's probably one of those. They've always been free, but they're now available through the Amazon store. But they're all really good books, so you can go ahead and get them. And then there's also Windows 10 Inside Out, which is in the second edition.
This
yes,
one's free.
That was
Windows 10 for IT professionals.
That one's free, and that one I need to update as well.
Yeah.
So I'm just doing updates these days, just like Microsoft. All I do is updates anymore.
Yeah. It's Paul Theroux, same thing. It's like they keep changing what's in Windows.
So that one that you were just on there, Windows
Inside
10
Out.
Inside Out, it has a current book service, which means that with each new feature update to Windows 10, we update the book and push it out there so that if you buy you buy the print book or the ebook, you get these updates and you'll get three updates over a year and a half or 2 years. So you're always up to date.
That's on the right way to do it. You have to do that.
That's the only way to do it now.
Yeah. Thank you, Ed. Always a pleasure. You're always so insightful. I really appreciate it. And Brian X Chen, thank you for coming all. Now, why do they make you use the X? Is it short for Xavier? Are you really a mutant?
No. Do I need to out myself? It's fake. It's,
there's no. There's nothing. It means nothing. It's to distinguish you from Brian, the other Brian.
So the story goes that in college, I was writing for my college paper, and there was another Brian Chen on campus.
Uh-oh.
He was claiming that he was writing the articles. So
bastard.
I don't have a middle initial at all. So I had to make one up, and the newsroom voted on X. And so
I love that.
It's been around forever.
I love that. The newsroom voted on X.
Yep.
You know what, though? It's memorable. You don't forget Brian X Chen. Look for his byline in the New York Times where he covers consumer tech.
And look out for the new cryptocurrency I'm starting called BXC.
Oh,
there you go.
Bingo.
Boom.
The X stands for nothing.
Hey, pleasure to be here. Thanks for having me.
Always a pleasure. Thanks for coming. I appreciate it. We do Twit every Sunday afternoon, 3 p.m. Pacific. I hope you'll come and watch live. 6 p.m. Eastern Time, 2300 UTC. You can stream it live at twit.tv/live. If you do that, do what Brian did. Join us in the chat room. Did you enjoy the chat room?
Yeah, it's fun.
They're nice guys. I steal all the best lines.
Hive mind is smart.
X makes everything cooler, says Luke Jello. irc.twit.tv. You can also be in our studio. We had a great studio audience today. Thank you guys for coming. It really is nice to have a live audience because I pay attention to your reactions. And if you seem bored, like when you fell asleep, I just moved to the next subject. if you want to be in studio, just email tickets at twit.tv. Of course, you can get every show we do on demand. That's how most people watch. You can nowadays ask your Amazon Echo or your Google Assistant, Google Home, or even your Invoke. If you're one of the five people having a Harman Kardon Invoke like me and Ed, you can just in most cases say ask let me hear Twit. Listen to the Twit podcast, something like that. Sometimes you have to say, listen to This Week in Tech, and you'll get the most recent episode. You can also listen to the live stream, listen to Twit Live. Sometimes you have to say Twit Live on TuneIn, depends on the device, but play around with it till you find out. And then that way, I think it's the best thing ever happened to podcasts. Makes it very easy. Works with HomePod too, if you have a HomePod. If you want to do it on your own schedule, I understand that as well. And that's easy. All you have to do is go to twit.tv and download an episode. Or better yet, subscribe. We have audio and video. The subscriptions work with any podcast client, including Apple's podcast client, Overcast, Pocket Cast, one of my favorites. If you subscribe, you'll always get the latest episode the minute it comes out. Thank you, everybody. Is tomorrow President's Day? I think it's a holiday, right?
Next week.
Next week? Oh, mm-hmm. Shoot. Well, have a good work day, and we'll see you next week on Twit. Another Twit is in the can. Bye-bye. Music.